You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Turkish Barbers, baby. They love this song. Actually, they love the video. Check it out. Kylie Minogue. Can't Get You Out of My Head. Playing over and over and over and over. In a barber shop at Camp Fallujah. That's what the guy asked me. Do you want the flame? Hell yeah, I want the flame, man. I'm not a pussy. No idea what the flame was, but other Marines around. Got to man up, man. The flame, hey, come on. How bad could it be? These other dudes are probably having it, so I got to have it. Yeah. Cotton swab at the end of a paperclip. In an alcohol bottle. Pulls it out. Lights it on fire. Burns the hair off your ears. Right? All the little white hairs. Hey, that wasn't so bad. It actually felt kind of good. I love the flame, man. Give me another one. Give me a double. I love that story because it's like stupid Marine shit. What? All these other Marines, right? And so, if I could paint it to... Right? Everybody, like... In there, it's got their weapons, right? Because you roll with your weapon. Rifles, pistols, right? Getting a haircut. You know, got a few minutes free, so go to the barbershop so you don't look like a bag of ass. Yeah, so it's like it's macho land. Yeah, you want the flame? Come on. Give it to me. Do I need to stick my tongue out? No, it's all right, man. Keep your tongue. Keep your tongue in your mouth. What? Come on. Yeah. Quien es más macho? Who is most macho? That's what counts. All right. I'm just finishing up a map. So what you're going to hear next, and I'm going to do a quick orientation for you right before I throw this map up. So Sangin, Afghanistan, okay? Sangin is in the Helmand province of Afghanistan where Marines fought and are today still advising. Yeah, advising. So where is Sangin? Well, it's in Afghanistan. All right? If you look at the map of Afghanistan and you look straight at Afghanistan where it says Afghanistan on the map, right in the center of the map, all right, if you go to the right and up, you're going to see the provincial capital. Okay, that is a place called, that's right, very good, Kabul. Yeah, it's a place called Kabul, or Kabul, depending on how sophisticated you are. Like, I joke in the interview, there's a place called Musakala. That's what Marines say. We're at Musakala. And then you hear people say, I was at Musakala. What, in France? No, in Afghanistan, like... You know, from Sangin, it's northwest from Sangin. Oh, Musakala. Musakala. Shut up with that shit, man. Anyway, yeah. Who's the smartest by virtue of pronunciation? Yeah, right. All right, so you got Kabul, and then if you go from the word on a map, you go to almost straight south. You run into some place that you've heard of, which is Kandahar. Okay? Most people that have read the news have heard Kandahar. Big base in Kandahar. Yeah. It's got a mall there. Yeah. It's got this quad, this square walkway, and around the walkway, And there's like basketball. There's like a roller hockey court. There's a football field. There's a basketball court all in the center of this quad. That's what gives you some kind of area idea of the quad. And then around that, there's a friggin' TGI Fridays in Kandahar. Yeah, and when you went home on leave, going to Kandahar, it's like going to the bar in Star Wars. You're like, where am I? Like, am I in Afghanistan? This is combat, son. Like, holy shit. This is what these people do every day. And they're like laughing and having fun. I'm like, holy smokes. Walking around. Wow. This is war. This is where NATO comes to do war. Okay, so anyway. So Kandahar is like almost due south of the center of the country. All right. So now, if you go from the word, if you go south and west, you find the Helmand province. Okay? And the way you know it's the Helmand province is there's all brown, but in the center of it, you see this green valley. And there's not much green on the map. Okay? Okay. And what does green mean? Green means farming. In Afghanistan, what does that mean? Opium. Who controls the opium? The Taliban. Why is it important to them? Because that's how they fund their operations, by supplying the world with opium. So who gets sent there to interdict the operation and to take their money from them? The Marine Corps. All right, so that's why we're in Sangin. So that's your general orientation to Afghanistan. So from the center of the country, up and to the right is Kabul, kind of in the at the foot of the mountains, okay, in the mountains. Right. If you come south, there's a big desert, right? And it flows out of the mountains, kind of down into the kind of flat land. Kandahar is in a flat part of that, but still kind of, there's still a lot of terrain around that, right? And if you go west from Kandahar, you run into the Helmand Valley. USAID project back in the day helped build irrigation canals. There's canals everywhere, right? And a source of big controversy there. Who owns them? Who controls them? Blah, 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 blah. Who uses them to dam them up? And Joe talks about this, to extort money from somebody else. All part of the game. Okay, so that's the general situation. And so you'll see the maps. You'll see those maps right now. Are on the website. Okay. So, as we go through the program, you'll see other maps that get added to it. So, without further ado, our battle study today, Sangin, and very graciously, Joe Patterson, Captain, United States Marine Corps, just gave up command of Kilo 35, joined us to talk about his deployment there as a first lieutenant in 2010, 2011. All right, we continue on a Wednesday, and I'll tell you, I've wanted to do these segments for a while, and but I will tell you, and I'm surprised at how popular that they have become, in terms of the number of people that listen to them. Wow. And so today we're going to talk about Afghanistan that, you know, blew up. I was just south of them when it happened in Afghanistan, working in the Marja area. They were a little bit north in the Sangin Valley, in the Sangin part of the Helmand Valley. And so we're talking to Captain Joe Patterson from Kilo 35. I just gave it up here in the last 30 days. And then, back in the day, in 2010, he was a platoon commander in India 35. Is that right, Joe?
That's right, man.
All right. So first of all, Joe, welcome back to All Marine Radio, and thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. The let's reintroduce you to everybody. So tell everybody, give everybody a little thumbnail about your career in the Marine Corps to date.
All right. Let's see. Enlisted in 97. Served as an avionics technician on Hughes and Cobras. Went over to be an instructor at Officer Candidate School in 2004. Watched the candidates there. Thought I could do that. Dropped the MESET package, Meritorious Enlisted Commissioning Education Program package. Got accepted. Went to college at Old Dominion University from 2006-2008. Commissioned in 2008, off to the basic school, infantry officer course, and then to India Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, where I was 3rd Platoon Commander. After the Sangin deployment that we'll talk about today, I went over to Weapons, served as a Weapons Company XO, and from there, Fire Support Coordinator as well, and was selected on the Commandant's Career Level Education Board to go to Expeditionary Warfare School. Wrapped that up in 2013, went to Bravo Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Team Company, served as a platoon commander there, and also the Department of State liaison officer / training officer, and then from there, in 2016, May of 2016, got orders back to 3-5, and I took Sledgehammer, Kilo Company, and I just gave that up about 30 days ago, and right now I work as the Deputy Pops Planner at 1st Marine Division.
Nice.
And that's me in a nutshell.
Nice. Yeah,
it's exciting.
Well, yeah, you did all the fun stuff as the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would say, now it's payback time. So good luck with that.
Payback.
No, good luck with that planning stuff. Sangin, right? Hear those words, and everybody, you know, I think is very interested because of the level of violence in Sangin. You guys are preparing to deploy. Talk to us about the mindset of your platoon and your company, the world that you lived in. And what had they done just previous to the Sangin deployment? I know that they were in 2006. They were around Fallujah with when I was there with RCT5. And so, talk to us about when you joined them, what they had been doing as you guys got ready to go over there.
Yeah, the. You know, I checked in 2009 after graduation of IOC, and they had just gotten back from a 31st new deployment. I think the deployment before that 31st new deployment was their last Iraq deployment that they had. And so there was a lot of, it's hard to explain, really. I think you'd have to be around 5th Marine enough to understand the level of pride that's in the regiment as a whole, and then to 3-5, you know, as a young lieutenant, like even as a prior enlisted guy, you know, I've heard about 3-5 before. So it was pretty neat to get assigned there, and then to show up there, you know, I was pretty nervous. Especially, you know, I hadn't been to combat before. No one was actually talking about combat when I got there. We were scheduled for a 15th new deployment. And so we went off and, you know, starting our training regiment. One of the things that I noticed, you know, now in hindsight, looking back, is from the first day I got there until we got back from the Sangin deployment, we were unknowingly preparing for it. I think, you know, we can probably get into that a little bit later, but what I mean by that is there was a lot of platoon white space time. So the platoon was able to get away from the company and conduct training as it saw fit based on strengths and weaknesses, and then the companies were afforded significant amount of time to train for the company commander and train his platoons. And then the battalion would come together, about two times, I think, before the deployment as a whole, where we'd do like a battalion test or something like that. But there was a lot of preparing for that independent, you know, distributed ops that would be found out later would be the, what would happen with us. And I think training-wise, unique for at least India Company was the battalion went to Bridgeport due to the Winter Mountain package.
Right.
And we didn't go. India Company stayed back, and we did training back on Camp Pendleton, and then we went as a lone company later for another winter training. And we went all by ourselves up there, and then from there, the company commander sent my platoon up the mountain by itself. And so I had, you know, weeks at a time on top of a mountain in cold weather, learning not just my own leadership, but developing squad leaders, developing team leaders, developing riflemen. And I'll never forget it. We were coming down off the mountain, I think this was February 2009, and my platoon was in a column, but we had flank security out, and we're coming down the mountain. I had guys running the ridge lines, and everybody's all got their white camouflage stuff on. Dispersion was perfect. They're using hand and arm signals. Nobody was talking, and they were communicating, and they looked beautiful. And I remember we went up the mountain, not a very young unit, and we came off the mountain there, and I remember thinking, I was standing on top, I was about, a squad deep, standing on top, looking down at my guys, kind of moved down the mountain, and I just thought, like, man, we're ready. And I'll never forget that moment. That was a highlight moment in my career, was looking at my platoon and realizing that they could probably handle anything now. So anyway, that's pretty much it. After Bridgeport, we geared up and went off to Enhance Mojave Rifle, and from there, singing.
All right. Talk to us about the composition of your platoon. 2006 to 2010 would mean that most of the guys who last fought with 3-5 are either out of the Marine Corps or have PCS'd. Some may have reenlisted and stayed. So talk to us about the level of experience and going into Senate. So when do you guys get told that you're going to Afghanistan and you're going to Senate?
We were told, I wanted to say, I can't remember if it was during that Bridgeport deployment or right thereafter. But it was definitely before Mojave Viper, which was in that summer. I can't remember if it was during Bridgeport or not, but I want to say it was following the mountain training. But composition of the platoon was, I had two Marines that had combat experience before. One of them was my platoon sergeant, and another one was one of my squad leaders. And then I got a couple more a little bit later, but those all got their corporal fire team leaders and whatnot shuffled around, but not a whole lot. And then when we got the word that we were, not going on the 15th MEU, and we are in fact going to Afghanistan. At first we were told we were going to Dalaran, and then later we found out it was Sangin. But I got an influx of Marines. So I had my squad leaders, two of them had come from Bravo or Second Pass, so they were exactly where I just, came from before. And they were best buddies, and that played out very well in combat later. And then I got two more sergeants from 3rd Marines, both of which had been deployed to Afghanistan in the early 2000s, right after September 11th, Operation Anaconda type stuff. And then they did another 3 combat tours to Iraq, and then they were coming to me, and they had been together since boot camp. And so I had, basically 4 sergeants that were just, in pairs, I guess, best friends, and they knew how to feed off each other. And that all of that really affected how well my platoon started to form. I got a new platoon sergeant right before. There was a sergeant in weapons platoon, Sergeant Walter Cardenas, and I wanted him as a platoon sergeant. I didn't care that he was a sergeant or whatever, but at Mojave Viper, he got promoted to staff sergeant, and I begged and begged and begged if I could have him, and they gave him to me. And so that the team was built, and it turned into the...
All right, stop. Hold on. Why did you want him? What had you seen in him that made you want him so much as a platoon sergeant?
Charisma, I think, would be... Charisma and humility would probably be the two things. I saw a man who had a lot of experience. He was in he fought in Ramadi. That had a small, element to it, but more than that, I just saw him care for his weapons platoon, Marines, just the way he was caring for them and the fact that he was going to be a staff sergeant. He needed a job, and I wanted to give him one, so it was, he knew how to instill discipline without, turning off, the care and compassion, so the Marines, were drawn to him, and he was still able to instill the, the fundamentals, the discipline thing that I really wanted to have in our platoon. So.
Okay. All right. So what do you, prior to the deployment, when did you guys first deploy?
We departed, it was the end of September.
All right.
Of 2010. Yeah.
Okay. So prior to leaving, when your mission gets changed, what do you learn about Sangin? What are you preparing mentally for, in terms of what are you going to do?
Yeah, so like I said earlier, it was going on with kind of the mission. So I'm trying to Google Earth and find out anything and everything I can. Looking, all of us were looking through anything that would tell us, where we're going and what it would look like. And when it switched over to Sangin, no one knew what that was. So I'm looking for anything on YouTube, and all I'm seeing is YouTube videos of the Brits, dropping bombs, and that it looks pretty like a pretty explosive place, but no one in the Marine Corps could really tell us anything. And then our battalion commander was able to reach out and find a guy who was with Echo 27, and they'd done a short time in Sangin, and I can't remember the year, but it was years earlier.
Yeah, it was years earlier, right? But extremely violent, extremely violent, right?
Oh, extremely violent, yeah. And so they brought in this captain who had taken them. I wish I could remember his name, but everything he told us, he spent an hour up there talking to us about what to expect, and I tell you, everything that guy told us, that saved lives, because it kind of got our mind really wrapped around, holy shit, this is for real. We're going to a place where it's not going to be, contact every now and then, this is going to be an all-out fight. And so that, we were able to take that information, get that down to the rifleman, and then start setting their mindset that we're going in for a fight, and it's going to happen, and we're going to do well because we're trained. And you start, building the expectations, and then setting new ones. And so we've got to focus our training just a little bit. But this is all, right before we go. So we deployed not knowing a whole lot. We were going to be running on the fly.
Got it. The next question for you. Give us an orientation in terms of Sangin. So if people are sitting at a computer and they pull up their Google Earth and we fly them to just type in Helmand, Afghanistan, and that will normally take you to a spot that has Marja as the center point. So walk us through Sangin. Give us a general orientation. And of the area.
Yeah, so if you did a Google poll like that, you'd see, Marja popped up. It's to the north. What you'd see, I think, in a map is two really large green sections that kind of come together in a center. And what that is, the Helmand River. And the Helmand River feeds, the Sangin Valley. The Sangin River Valley is very, lush. Okay, so if you're looking at a satellite image, the only green place in Helmand, really. And where those two green spots come together, that thing. But it's north of Marja. It's north of Kandahar and Leatherneck. Not by a whole lot, by mileage. You can get there easily in a day, but for us, it's like eternity. We're out there by ourselves, far, far away. But, and then to the north of Sangin, you have a place called Kajakian. That's where the Helmand River kind of, there's a giant dam up there, and it's, basically, they dam the river, and then they use that the dam to create electricity for the southern areas when they had it and all that stuff. So, that's about the best I can give you without looking.
Okay.
Pointing the finger at a map.
No, I think so. When you if you look in the center of the map, And if you put Tsang in the center, if you go the river forks at about Sangin, right? If you go essentially north, how do you say it? Do you say it Musikale? Do you say Musikala? How do you say that?
I say Musikala. I don't know what the proper thing is, but yeah, exactly. North Musikala.
Yeah, you hear the smarter guys go. I was in Musikale. Like, is that Musikala? Is that Musikala? Yes. I'm like, oh, all right, man. I thought you were someplace else. And so, yeah, if you go straight north, you go to Musikala. If you go kind of northeast, you go to Kajaki. If you come south along the river, you hit the major east-west highway at what is that? Gerishak? How do you say that?
Garish.
Yeah.
You're talking about Ring Road.
There you go. So you hit that, and that takes you to where Joe said they were originally supposed to go, which would have been Fob Delaram, out further west. If you continue to go south along the river, you'll come to the provincial capital of Lashkar Gah. So that's the provincial capital. And then if you continue to go kind of southwest on a road, you wind up in the Marja area, and you keep going south, and you head towards the Iranian border. West of the provincial capital is a city that just about everybody's heard of, and that is Kandahar in Kandahar province. So home of a big Air Force base, a place where we sent all our gunshot wounds to the head because they had a brain surgeon there. So that's kind of the general layout of where Sangin sits. Give us, before we talk about your platoon and the specific situation, give us a bit of an intel summary, of who was up there. So I'm sure when you heard the Echo 27 stuff, cause I can't remember who I spoke to that was with them, and they said, It was amazing because they would close with you. Because a lot of times, both in Iraq and other places, they'll shoot at you, they'll ambush you, right? If they hurt you bad, they'll close with you a little bit to inflict more casualties. But they know our ROE, our rules of engagement, and they know our aviation support times. So they've got a stopwatch in their head. When they get to about 10 minutes, they're breaking contact because they know something's en route. And so, but this, the Echo 27 comment was, no, these guys, they will mass and they will close with you. And that's what made our fighting there different. So who are those guys, Joe? What made them different? And what were you guys told going in there?
So told going in there, like, not much. After we got the brief from the Echo 27, captain, the next pieces of information we got were when we got to Leatherneck, we landed, got our, in briefs for a couple days, and then we're talking with Brits who were on their way out of Sangin, and they were basically just saying, good luck, mate, like, they'd suffered 104 dead up there in a few years, so they were happy to be leaving, and they were freaking us out a little bit. We didn't know much going in. I'll tell you this as far as the enemy goes, and I'll just throw out a blanket statement up front. This will be from my perspective, whether or not my perceptions of who I was fighting are correct based on, intel or not, I won't be able to, I won't know. But I'll tell you I do know there were some, networks that were operating up there, that I'll just stay away from naming them, but there's some, very organized, insurgent networks that were operating in Sangin. So that was one. We had also, I called them immigrants, but we had fighters from other countries, coming over, and you could pick, once we're in the AO for a little bit, you can pick those guys out pretty quick. They're just dressed there. They didn't fit in. So from neighboring countries, we'd get a few fighters in there from there, we'd get some snipers in from some of the other areas, but when I start talking about, like, specific to Sangin, we kind of divided them into, you know, two to three groups, really. And we had the green zone, we called them the dirty Taliban, even though we felt as though we weren't fighting Taliban. We didn't know if we were fighting Taliban, so we were actually directed by higher, you know, like, hey, these are just, you're fighting the enemy because we don't know if they're Taliban or not. Like, whoever's shooting at you may not be. So, we were fighting, what we call the dirty ones up in the northern green zone, southern green zone area, and those were like your farmer types, and they looked, dirty. They were constantly their clothes were, all disarrayed. They weren't groomed well, when compared to the other group, which would be in the fish tank area, the urban side. They were a little bit more clean, a little bit more educated than the guys in the green zone. And it was our belief after, living there and operating there for, 7 months was the urban brown zone, and this makes sense too. The urban brown zone were receiving money and paying benefits basically from something somewhere outside of Sangin. They were using those things to finance, the fighting elements that we encountered in the, in the green areas. And then, they would fight us, the financer type people would fight us also in the brown zone area, the urban area they would fight. But you wouldn't find them fighting us in the green zone, and their tactics were completely different. So we had several different IED cells that would operate. We'd find different, the ways they'd employ the IEDs would be different than the other, and we'd get into contact in one area, direct fire contact, and then close and maneuver on them only to get attacked by another group that fought completely different. So there was a lot of learning early, and I will tell you, the quantity of enemy was extensive. There was a lot of bad guys there. I've seen this literally when we first got there anyway, everyone there wanted to, would engage us, given the, the right opportunities and whatever. And they would, especially, the guys in the green zone, and Kilo Company had to deal with it more than even I did, but you'd see them, they would mass and they would maneuver on you. And they would not break contact for anything unless it blew up. So I've watched guys enemy assault into 50 cal machine gun fire and keep gunning. And then, you start throwing two or threes or mortars at them and that freaks them out. And air definitely helps, of course. The fact that I'll tell you this, like I have a hatred for the enemy that goes beyond probably talking about.
Right.
But my respect for them is extremely high. They're some of the most courageous, people. I felt kind of honored that we were in and some of the things I might say might sound weird to some people, but I was kind of happy that we were fighting a legit group of bad guys, and my platoon felt the same way. Like these guys weren't cowards. Like at least they honored us by being brave. If that makes sense. I mean, they all died, but at least they went down like you should if you're going to call yourself a warrior. So the posture culture was very strong with them. And, they gave us a good run.
Okay. I want to do, that's interesting because I watched, one day I watched, Merc, chat traffic. First Recon Battalion had been working for us. And
yep.
then chopped, to RCT2. And then I think they transitioned to RCT8, but RCT2 was who you initially went to work with up there.
Mm-hmm.
And, First Recon Battalion went there. So they got into a fight and I want to say they killed 200 to 300 guys. And so you're watching this fight happen and you're able to see some drone feed. But, I was paying attention to RAO, so I pulled up First Recon's battalion chat window, and they were talking about they're forming in the tree line to counterattack. And, and you heard everybody in our COC, so we're 1st Marine Regiment, and we're down, I don't know how many miles, 60 miles, 30 miles, I don't know how many miles we are south of you, but you heard somebody say, holy shit, First Recon's being counterattacked. And everybody stopped and said, what? And everybody had kind of the same feeling, like, yeah, let's do this. Like, finally, somebody's going to stand and fight.
Yeah.
After months of chasing them and the frustration, it's like, holy shit, this is going to be a straight-up fight. This is awesome. And it is. You have to admire that, especially when you know what they know. It's not like they don't know what they're up against. And when you tighten your headdress and you say, okay, boys, let's go, and they go, I mean, you have to respect that as a warrior. So I'm with you. Give us before we talk about you guys relieved 3-7, yes?
Yes.
Okay, before we talk about
you said that actually.
Yeah, before we talk about your rip with them, let's just kind of dial down into your battle space. The map I'm looking at is in your slides. Kind of walk us through the Sangin Wadi. Is the dominant kind of east-west terrain feature. Then you have the river, right? Then you have the valley that's green that you call, do you call that the green zone?
Yes, yeah. Okay. Southern green zone and northern green zone.
Okay, and then the urban area, that you talk about. So just kind of, now that we're looking at that map, kind of walk us through. And for those of you who are out there, obviously you can blow these images up and you can go to Google Maps and find, you know, a lot of the same stuff if you want to zoom in greater detail or stuff like that. So walk us through just first of all, let's do terrain and then we'll talk about the different zones. So the Sangin Wadi, did it ever fill up with water? Did it rain that much? Simply a dry, you know, late former riverbed used for transportation. Tell us about the Sangin Wadi.
So the Sangin Wadi was probably a good 300 meters wide. I never saw water in it. Grant, we got there, you know, October is when we really started operating, and so everything was still very green, and you know, it seemed like, you know, the river was full and all that stuff. It dried out a little bit later, but even then, the Wadi never had water. From my standpoint, it was a primary way for the enemy, the civilians, and us to get into areas quickly. So you look at runs east and west, and get into the eastern desert from the district center. And then what the eastern desert would allow them to do is they can get up into, you know, all the way up, they can move up to Kajaki that way. Through some unimproved roads up in the north. They didn't have to take Route 611. They have access to the fish tank area, which is an urban maze of just, you know, 12-foot high walls and compounds and houses in there that make no sense. So there's no, like, rhyme or reason how the structures were put in there. They're just in there. But sticking to the Wadi here, the Wadi was, when we first got there, it was considered an IED belt, or several IED belts were in it.
Okay.
And they hadn't been identified yet, and so travel in vehicles was terrifying. And that was the first op that I got assigned, was I had to bring the company to Wishton. I had to make 5 trips one way in 7 tons, and then 5 trips back through the Sangin Wadi. And that was within, I don't know, 5 days of landing in the district. And that was my first task.
Okay, talk to us about movement. Tell everybody what led the movement, you know, so you're going to roll like that in an area that's notorious for IEDs. As you said, you wouldn't be sane if you weren't terrified. Mine roller in front every time you went, or yes or no?
At the beginning, yes. That was a requirement, was my understanding. We had 2 Vics in the front, both with mine rollers. You know, MRAPs, MATVs was the vehicles of choice for the, you know, running your lead Vics and your rear Vics. And we were rolling around at 7 tons also. So, I mean, it was, the way we did it was, again, and you'll hear this kind of come out multiple times today, like the ingenuity of an awesome Marine, and this was the first example of this, was a sergeant. He's like, we're concerned we're going to blow up. I mean, getting into the wish, like driving in the Sangin Wadi. And he's like, sir, you know what I'm going to do? I was like, what? He's like, I'm going to roll down to the Wadi, through the district center, and I'm going to wait to see a civilian car, you know, driving down the Wadi, and I'm just going to tailgate him. and like hold, you know, and so that's how we did our first trip. Was we got behind a civilian. That civilian car was going as fast and left and right and zigzagging everywhere he could to lose us. But he wound up helping us clear the wadi with the mine rollers. We knew we wouldn't blow up if we were following a civilian car. So that's what we did.
All right. So that's the Sangin Wadi. Talk to us about the river. How deep is the river? It looks like it breaks up into a number of little streams that kind of wind through the area that you guys operate in. Tell us about the Sangin River right there where it forks.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't tell you how deep it is. My guess is pretty deep. I didn't do any river crossings in it. That was kind of our AO boundary, but
okay.
It had some pretty wide spots, had some narrow areas. It ran pretty quick. But it was basically the river itself was you can imagine all the green you can see there, that's all farmland. So they use it mostly to irrigate all their crops. And then, you know, you had the enemy out there, they would dam it up in certain areas to like dry out other people's crops who weren't, you know, seeing eye to eye with them. So the river was, we're talking about key terrain. The control of that water, was pretty important for the people there. But also for the enemy, because it, you know, basically they're growing poppy, and that's their primary source of income. So, the river was important, but it was never an obstacle for us because it was basically our boundary.
Okay. Now tell us about the green zone. The green zone is down in the Sangin River Valley, yes? And this is, had there been much USAID work? Because the only reason Marger even existed was because of a USAID project down there that irrigated the living hell out of that area and turned it into some of the great opium fields on the planet. Had there been much USAID canal work up in the Sangin area?
So I couldn't speak to know if USAID did it or not, but you can. The canal work was extensive. I mean, like especially if some of the listeners get on and they look at Google, you can see the canals and the ditches that were all dug, and the little levees that were done, and it really flowed water in very well. And like you said, poppy all of that green that you see on the map, for the most part, there's some corn, some wheat a little bit, but the primary deal there was the poppy, so.
Okay.
It was extremely marsh-like. So, like, almost, and when the water was flowing well, it was, like, swampy. So extremely hot and humid. The corn in some of the fields, you know, like get up to 10 feet high, right? And it's just, you know, you're walking in shin deep mud. It's very, very like southern Louisiana where I grew up, like very, or at least in my early years.
Without the gumbo.
Very pretty.
Without the gumbo.
Yeah, without the gumbo. Yeah.
All right, just want to make sure. Talk to us about the compounds that you on somebody's piece of real estate that they're growing crops on or whatever. Tell us about what's typical in terms of where the family lives. Walled compound, couple of houses, one for the family, one for your in-laws or somebody else. Talk to us about what was typical of Sangin.
Yeah, so in the green zone area, You'd see about a 10, 12 foot wall, that would surround, some living quarters for the people inside. And it's all made of, I think of it back to like biblical days. I mean, it's like, you could see them making some of their giant bricks out of straw and water and mud, but, it kind of resembled what you can imagine would be like back in the old days. But, inside there, there'd be, a couple places for the family to stay. There'd be, a wood fired oven. There'd be, a lot of times some of the crops that would, that would sustain them would be inside.
Okay.
So like, so they have little corn, like vegetable gardens or whatever. They usually have a goat or two. And then some werewolf type dogs would kind of be there, inside to protect.
Okay, stop. When you say werewolf type dogs, if you tell people, I did this with Mike Musselman one day, we started talking about dogs in Afghanistan. Okay, can you compare a dog in the United States to a dog in Afghanistan?
No. Yes, I can draw a visual for you. I don't know what you saw where we were. They cut the ears off, they cut the tails off, and these things were, one, that made them look kind of scary. Two, they were huge.
Kind of scary?
And they hated. Yeah, they were terrifying. we were more scared of the dogs than half of the other stuff out there. And we made a statement was like everything in this country wants to kill you, from the flies to the Taliban hornets is what we called them, to the werewolves. But they would attack full bore attack you. So yeah.
And again, if you think we're joking, do a search on Afghan bear dog. Okay. Right? And when you talk to Marines, and Joe's not joking, talk about terrified, absolutely terrified of these dogs. And they're gigantic. They're monsters. Okay, so you got a dog chained. Musselman tells the story. He said, I was on patrol with somebody, and I look and I see, we're going into this compound. I look and I see this chain, and it looks like something that you would chain, like, Godzilla too, okay? And he says, and I look at him like, why would they use something that heavy, a chain that heavy? And then around this corner, this dog comes, and he's like, aah. He said, we started screaming like 3-year-old girls running. And this thing was ginormous. But, when you hear Marines telling it, it is so funny. So I just we're not joking about this, all right, when we talk about dogs. Okay, so wall compound, you got a dog in there. Anything else interesting about the way this area is constructed? You said down in the green zone, ankle, or shin deep mud and marshy area. Anything else about the terrain?
Yeah, if you're getting on, if you're walking around the green zone, there's paths and trails and whatnot. If you get off those, you're talking, you're walking around in some pretty deep stuff. It sucks. But if you're walking on the trails, then, you're predictable. So it's, back and forth. The doors, usually they have like steel doors sometimes. Sometimes they just be covered with the sheets, so it varied. But the threat in the green zone with IEDs was generally around the compound. So, and the compounds are more spread out, like you'd see in like a, everything like Ohio or something like that, where they had their farms, the compounds would be spread out a couple hundred meters between, living quarters. And in the brown zone, they were right on top of each other. So there's alleyways that we've gone through that you couldn't fit through with all your gear on. That skinny. And it's the only way to navigate through to get to another part of the area. And I guess the key takeaway there with the structures is they're bulletproof. There's some of these compound walls, 20 mic from a Cobra is not shooting through it. So 50 cal is not going to penetrate it either. And you start talking about the enemy carving holes in the walls, they'd shoot out, little firing ports. It's the perfect firing position because there's very small chance that our rounds are going to come through those holes. So.
Okay. Takeaway. The biggest threat you face down in the green zone was?
I'd say the biggest threat in the green zone was the enemy numbers-wise. So, the Marines, as we started getting into the deployment, preferred to go to the green zone because they got to shoot at people and shoot back. And it wasn't just IEDs, with IED-led ambushes. So in the green zone, it was bad guys, lots of them. That was where strategy and tactics and, But the biggest threat in the green zone would be the gunshot. I'd say the IED is right next to that. In fact, depending on who you ask and what AO we're talking about, or even which company or even platoon, they may disagree with me. We struck a couple IEDs in the green zone, but nothing like in the fish tank area or Whiston area. But most of the IEDs, you could almost predict where they would be if you're paying attention. So that's my opinion. I think would be the biggest threat was the good firefight that would happen there.
All right, talk to us. And so the people that live in the green zone, I would think primarily farmers. Yes. Are they the people?
Yeah.
Are they the people work in the land? And so what's the difference between, as we look at your map, the people that live in the green zone and the people that live in the brown zone, the more urban area? Who's living where? Are the owners of the farms living in the brown area? They're more wealthy, and the people that work on the farms are living in the green area. What's the difference between who's living where?
You know, so I learned all of the above while I was there asking the same questions. Sometimes we'd find like some sort of sharecropping was going on.
Right.
We'd find that some people would come there during the harvest or planting and harvesting seasons only, and they would work their farms. We found some of the richer people in the fish tank area were paying. They also had farms in the green zone, and they were paying families, you know, to farm their stuff, stuff like that. So it's kind of a little bit of all of the above.
Okay.
But for the most part, in the green zone, it was, you know, farming people, farming families. And then when you got into the closer, for me, at least what we'll talk about later today, is get closer to the Hellman River, and you start looking at the structures start becoming more slummy-like. And this is where you start, just like in America, where if you're paying attention and you start looking at where the poverty is, you can probably find some criminal elements. And then because, you know, they're trying to make a buck or whatnot, and the Taliban or the enemy really focused in on that. And we'd find the closer to the Hellman River we got, basically the farther away from U.S. patrol bases we got, you'd find guys not farming, living in the green zones. You're like, well, what are you doing here? And that's, it's kind of like their organized crime bases were at least in my AO, were closer to the Hellman River. So it's a hard question to answer because there's so many different pockets of different kinds of people, all with different motivations for why they're there.
All right. No, that makes sense. Are the houses nicer in either place, or does it just depend which block you're walking on?
No, I'd tell you the fish tank area, the houses were nicer. And you could tell that because the walls, they would smooth them out a little bit better, and the structures were usually a bit cleaner.
Okay, just so when we talk fish tank, we're talking the brown side, the urban part of Sangin.
Yep.
On the east side of Route 610.
Okay. Yeah, left south side of 611, yeah.
South side.
There were two or three buildings in...
No, 610 is at the basic school. That's Garrisonville, out the back end. Just so sorry about
that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But no, there was a couple buildings in the AO that were reinforced concrete, which was very, very strange to us. In fact, one of them was, you know, owned by the U.S. military over, it was Bob Jackson. And then the other one that I was aware of anyway was about 400 meters away from my patrol base that we wound up occupying, but... at some point, somewhere in their history, something was there and that brought money because there were some very nice concrete buildings, which you don't see anywhere. These are all, you know, mud huts. And so it was interesting.
Yeah. And you know, we probably built them years ago and got, you know, that's why. Because if it's lousy construction that the Russians made, you can tell, right? It jagged corners, irregular shapes. You're like, who did that? Oh, the Russians must have done that. Those drunk asses. And then you see something that looks like finished, and you're like, whoa. What is that in the middle of nowhere? All right, let's talk about your turnover with 3-7. Were you going into an area that had been worked? And tell us about 3-7, how long they'd been there, and tell us about your turnover.
Yeah, so I showed up, I think we landed at like 2300 on a day. And then the next morning I got to go on my first patrol, and that was, I got to meet this man named Lieutenant K. And he basically was operating out of the patrol base that I would eventually take. And then he was also operating out of another patrol. So his platoon was split between two patrol bases. And, we went to go basically do a leader's recon to figure out which one that I would eventually take over and basically do a look at it. And so we go to the first one, Patrol Base Nabi. That's in the Northern Green Zone. He's basically sharing it with some Afghan nationals. And we get there and this first contact, we get into a little small gunfight by by our standards later. Finished with that, and then we moved to patrol base Vlad, where the rest of his platoon is. And so as I'm talking with him, as we pull into patrol base Vlad, I see his platoon sergeants kind of running around, acting, you know, like something's going on. Yeah, and they had just taken sniper fire as we were pulling up. And so they had orchestrated an airstrike on a sniper position. So this was like my first, like, hey, welcome to combat. You know, like literally I've been in country maybe 8 hours. And I've already been shot at. I've already watched three airstrikes go. And it was insane. I was like, this could be a long deployment. But I get up there and he's talking to me about his, you know, his manpower and his guys, and they're not able to patrol much because the most they can put out on a patrol is about 8 guys because he's spread out protecting, you know, 2 patrol bases. And he's saying, 8 guys is the minimum that you're, you know, allowed to leave the wire with. And he said, you know, they get ambushed quite a bit. And, they've done some really good work as much as they could. He showed me where they were able to get to, but essentially it equated between, patrol base lodges right off the 611 and then a little bit into the green zone and in between.
Okay.
And they've gotten to, you know, stick their nose out there and they've run into some significant, contact. I mean, that's where, you know, that's like the best information I got about the enemy was he's like, they will maneuver on you, take as many guys out as you can, you know, because that's what's going to happen. And they're scared of 203s, they're scared of grenades, and they're scared of mortars. You get arrows, you know, like he's giving me all this stuff. And he'd only been there maybe, I don't know exactly, I want to say two weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a month. And so he was, you know, he apologized because the patrol base looked like crap. He took it over from the Brits. And there was no force throw on it. A Brit got stabbed on that patrol base because guys were able to walk inside. So this is, you know, going to be our new home. And, the force protection on it was, it was non-existent. I think Lieutenant K had put up some nets so that they couldn't throw grenades over the walls anymore. So there was, when I got there, there was probably 20-foot high cargo nets, that were meant to, like, deflect grenades as they got thrown over the walls because the patrol base was, you know, shared a wall with an Afghan compound, and there was no meaningful force pro. They had put up some fake cameras. They built some MRE boxes and turned them into what looked like a camera, and then took some 550 cord, ran it out the back, and painted them white so they looked like we had, like, observation cameras. Like, they tried the best that they could, and they did some good work. Before we got there and actually ripped out with them. But, they were just undermanned. They were just trying to hold the place long enough for us to get there.
All right. The, so bottom line is they hadn't been out, the guys you replaced hadn't been able to do much offensive operations in any area, simply because
I say that, but I say no, as far as how we would categorize offensive ops. They killed some bad guys. 3-7 did. It was probably one of the same days you're talking about with the recon. There's an election day, and the bad guys would, you know, try to maneuver on pretty well, and every time they'd meet a U.S. Marine and realize, like, that was a bad idea. And we heard that a lot from the locals as we got there. But some of the things, I think, when we start talking offense, that he was able to do for us was they had identified a friendly village. They identified a school teacher that spoke English and kind of gave us our first foot in the door to kind of like, hey, go. So like the way that our battalion commander wanted to fight the fight was be aggressive, be extremely aggressive, find the bad guys and kill them. Simultaneously, find the good guys and you know, let them see that we are doing good. And put the Afghan face on everything. So kind of running both, I think, mindsets behind counterinsurgency. So find the bad guys and kill them, and also, you know, treat the people well and, you know, do that sort of thing.
All right.
So we did both. And so and what 3-7 gave my platoon was a village that was supportive of Jairola, the government of Afghanistan, and not supportive of the Taliban or the enemy, whoever was in the area. And so we had that to start with. And that was huge because that paid dividends later that were extremely helpful for us. So in that short amount of time, you know, they didn't do much offense. They did a few things where they went up into the green zone to try to push back some bad guys. But they weren't given enough time, and they probably didn't have the manpower to do it.
All right. All right, so now transition us to your platoon, AO. So we've gone kind of through the orientation, the green zone, Route 611. The fish tank is the brown side, the urban area, north of the Sangin Wadi is referred to the fish tank. The Wishtan area, south of the Sangin Wadi, on the brown side, and then the district center, obviously, people can see from your map, and then the southern part of the green zone. Talk to us, on the next map that everybody has, talk to us about how when you went, so you're there, how your platoon gets set up.
Okay, so we want to take a patrol base Falad. That's right smack in the middle of the fish tank area, the brown zone. It's also allowed me to overlook Route 611 and keep that open from, you know, IEDs getting placed on the main road. Right before we decided on we're going to take patrol base Falad, got it, and then we wound up doing the Wishton op that I was referring to earlier. We basically took the company down to south of the Sangin Wadi into an urban area, and we did a clear to allow Lima Company to occupy our patrol bases, and our company bought down there. And that was, of the 10 trips that we made through the Sangin Wadi, I think 7 of those were in contact. So by the time we had gotten to occupy our platoon patrol base, which is October 10th time frame, 11th maybe, we had already, most of the platoon had already received and returned fire. The company, unfortunately, had already lost a Marine, and that was John Sparks, and then the battalion had already lost, I think, I want to say up to 10 at that point. And then, you know, many casualties, and we've been there, you know, not very long. So we take over our platoon patrol base in the fish tank, and I asked the company commander before I start operating, if he'll give me 3 days to conduct force protection, because the first few nights were, you know, it's like I have the whole platoon awake on stand two because there are so many gaps where infiltrators could come in at night and, you know, put grenades in where we're sleeping and so on. So we started denoting a couple things and then setting our force pro up. It took about 3 days to do that. And then once we did that, we were ready to rock and roll. And so
okay,
my first patrol that I just...
Hold on. No, that's all right. And again, my guest today is Joe Patterson. We're talking about the 3-5's deployment to Sangin. In 2010-2011, Joe is a rifle platoon commander, 1st Platoon, India Company 3-5. Talk to us about the impact of the number of casualties that you guys took early on everybody. Life changes a lot when those names aren't names that you don't know anymore. Those are people that you know that are no longer with us. What effect does that have on your guys, and what effect did it have on you?
It's obviously it's difficult, but I think if I'm going to be completely honest, during the deployment, it happened so often that it was just not sensitive. It happened so often, and we knew, everybody volunteered for what we were doing. I think our mindset behind it, and I can't speak for everybody that was out there, just myself, but the way that we looked at it, or I looked at it, is, we're here, and we're being aggressive. We're doing what Marines do. Yes, we're taking casualties, and I know that, 3-5 took a bunch. And I used to get really upset when people would talk about, when you guys are getting your ass kicked or whatever. And I can tell you there's not one time when, any of the Marines in Dark Horse got their ass kicked. It's because we were aggressive and we did what Marines should be doing and have done, more than 200 years. And that's when we saw the enemy, we'd go for them. And, that comes at a cost, but it also, I'm not going to take away from any of the guys who got hurt or killed because they did what they were wanting to do. I think they'd all tell you that. But we're kind of, I guess, to answer your question, it started, you know, morale fluctuates based on, there was a time, and I wrote in my journal, and, you know, I had lost a couple of good buddies of mine, you know, lieutenants, not just maimed and wounded, but killed. And, you know, like I was, there was a point there where, like, when's my turn? You know, like, when am I going to, you know, when is my platoon going to run into something that we can't fight our way out of? And you have those thoughts, and then they go right out of your, they leave pretty quick when you get outside the wire. So those are thoughts that kind of happen, while you're having downtime.
So let me ask you, because I think that one of the interesting things that after you do go fight, do you recall a scene in Band of Brothers where that lieutenant by the name of Spears encounters that private by the name of Blythe, and Blythe is suffering traumatic blindness. So during firefights, he blocks, his eyesight goes away. And then it comes back, and at first they think something's wrong, you know, that he's just a coward. And then they realize that it's something physical brought on by, you know, whatever's going on in his head. And this Lieutenant Spears said, Blythe, you have to accept that you're already dead in order for you to function. When you do, you'll be able to function like a soldier. And I don't know that I would absolutely endorse that exact verbiage, but I think everybody has to make peace with, I don't know how this is going to turn out, and there's a good chance that I may not live. But I'm not going to fail these Marines that I fight with. Talk about your thoughts about that, because you guys did suffer casualties, and there's no way that when you're in that situation, those thoughts don't go through your head. How did you make peace with that?
In a lot of ways, really. So there was days there, and I'll just again speak for myself. I can't speak for my guys.
Sure.
For me, anyway, there were days when that we're about to pull the gate back on our to exit friendly lines, which we had this gate, and I'm like, all right, this is it, you know, like all these thoughts go through your head, and I'm kind of content with this, you know, if I fall or whatever the case is for me. But then I start thinking about like, how's my son going to take it, or how's my daughter going to take it, or how's my wife going to take it, and that's when those emotional kind of feelings come to mind. You have to block that out, like, in my opinion, right? I can't be thinking about that. That gate swings open, and it's time to play ball. It's all gone, and then you go out on patrol and you do your job. And I can distinctly remember the day when we were getting engaged, and it was rounds were cracking very close to where I was. I was in an alley, and I remember thinking, screw this. Like your first instinct is to take cover. Well, there's nowhere to take cover because you're in an alley. And so, you know, you just take off after the guy that in the direction you think the guy's shooting. I remember running down an alley by myself, unloading a magazine. And then that was just, I don't know why that day sticks out to me, but that was the day when I stopped really kind of caring about where to seek cover, take cover, and if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And there's been other times during the deployment where some kind of unexplainable things happened, and I started feeling like I was kind of, that sounds silly, and your listeners are probably going to laugh at me, but like there was times when I just felt invincible, and I can recall multiple times when we're in an alley and a machine gun opened up on the other end, and how I didn't get hit was on my, like, bullets moving out of the, like, pulp fiction. It happened two or three different times, and
wow.
And I'm sure it happened to my guys multiple times too, because I mean, some guys got hit and some guys didn't. And how do you justify who got hit and who didn't? Like, I mean, I was standing next to two guys that got hit, and I didn't. So it makes no sense when you look at my trajectory of rounds. And so I started feeling like, you know, maybe when my time's up, it's someone's higher, you know, it's, God in my case, that it's just, there's something I'm meant to do and accomplish, and until I accomplish that, I'm not touchable. And I kind of, that's kind of how I handle my day to day. I sent you a picture, actually. I'll send it if I didn't. I'm standing on an IED. And the second I step off of it, one of my Marines steps right where my foot was, because that's what you're supposed to do. And he blew up. So how do you explain that? You know, it's just different.
You don't. No, you don't. And I'll tell you, and some guys have struggled with it, you know, for years. And there is a randomness to combat that you're talking about. Why does it hit him and miss me? But you know, what I say is the God who governs the flight of metal through the air is a fickle God. And don't waste your time trying to understand what he or she is doing. Just do your best.
Yeah.
Just do your best and accept that it's out of your hands. But it's hard. And that's why I asked you, because one of the best parts about this battlefield study is it's not simply the tactical piece, but there's a whole lot that goes into the emotional preparation. And that's why, you know, in that series, why can't I think of the name of it now? The one about World War II. I want to say In Good Company, but that's not it. What is it? Dick Winters?
Band of Brothers?
Yeah, sorry about that. Band of Brothers. you hear these things, and they're full of wisdom, but I don't know that you can understand them until after you've gone through the experience at least once. And then when you hear
I agree with you.
And then when you hear it, you're like, wow, that is so profound. And somebody look at you and say, well, what do you mean? And you're like, I don't know that I could. It's going to take me a while to explain it if you want to listen to it. But I think that's really important that when you hear people talk about that, the randomness and trying to deal with death and trying to go to sleep at night. And as you said, I stepped there, and he stepped where I stepped. And it blew up. Well, that's not supposed to happen, right? Because the first guy is clearing. I'm following where he's stepping, right? Nothing. He hasn't found anything. He hasn't triggered anything. And lo and behold, you know, he steps on it after I miss it. And, so it's interesting the way everybody makes peace with it.
And the thing to your Band of Brothers thing is like, you know, as people in this profession for your listeners too, especially the younger guys, like watch things like that and read things like that. They should, because like I consider myself, you know, a student of history, and I read a lot before I went, specifically on Killam, for example, came to mind nearly every day on that deployment, because this kind of goes into the topic. We were dealing with multiple casualties. We were dealing with violence. We were dealing with it at ranges that should affect us mentally. For me, just deploying like the PME program beforehand, even though you may not know what it means, it will mean something to you once you do go through that experience on the back end. So like, I didn't have any issues. I didn't think much about, you know, the humanity and behind this deployment until 6, 7, 8, 9 months afterwards. And then things really started to sink in. And that's when, I relied heavily on like the stuff I'd read in the past to kind of prepare me for things that I might or might not go through. It doesn't mean like you go to war, you're already jacked up in your head, but you think about things. Like the thing that bothers me the most, I think, is those, the men that I went with, I love every one of them. And I want like nothing more, but their happiness in life. And we didn't come back with some, and that kills me. To their parents, like the, you know, some of the ones we lost, like they're still on that deployment. And I start thinking about like the family behind it really bothers me, but that's the job, I suppose.
No, and hopefully we all encounter people that teach us about that before we go, and they understand, you know, we all understand about our moral obligation, to educate ourselves and be the leader that people need, not that people want. Be the need to instill discipline in garrison when we're back here, because guess what? You know, as Joe said, you know what, 5 hours after he got there, he was out there. There was no spin-up time and we're all going to get salty and get locked on. You will go the way you have been and the way you have existed in peacetime CONUS. And if you're not disciplined, if you're not squared away, you're going to pay. You're going to pay a higher price in terms of the number Marines and whoever else is working for you that are killed and wounded. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Literally, it's heartbreaking. And so hopefully you have leaders that, that mentally prepare you and that you accept that, that heavy burden of responsibility that leadership is in the combat arms, especially in Marine Corps infantry. Because you will, you know, you will close with them and you will destroy them. And hopefully you do that in a very, very efficient way so that you can bring everybody back. But it's, let me tell you, it is a rough profession. It is a rough profession. Interesting, Joe.
We continue with, Joe Patterson, the, 3rd Platoon Commander, India 3-5 for the Sangin deployment. The, Joe, I want to talk about as we kind of finish painting, a picture of, you know, of the AO that you operated and the circumstances under which you operated in 2010-2011 in Sangin. Talk about the kind of IEDs you saw on a regular basis, and then if you would, talk about how you guys dealt with those. So what kind of IEDs did you see on most often?
Sure, yeah. I think it really matters. It mattered on which part of Sangin we were in. I would say, like, I could give it, and again, I think it varied from even platoon AOs, but definitely between company AOs.
Let me ask you a question. Does that all have to do with ID maker? So you got this guy making them over there. You got this guy making them who likes to make them like this over here. You got another guy making them over there. Is that what that corresponds to, AO of bomb makers?
You know, that's my opinion. We definitely saw from the HME quality, we could definitely tell if it was a different IED maker. Some of the stuff was really, really good. It would crack really loud or make a different noise when it exploded compared to other guys. And then I think it came down to experience level and training level of the enemy. So, like I said, we found a no kidding terrorist boot camp is what we called it up. When we did that ops that I talked about yesterday, so I think a little bit of both. The HME when it was made by the untrained guys, it would still explode, but we'd find a lot of low order. It would, you know, partially explode. Sometimes if it did fully explode, it didn't have the punch that some of the more experienced guys. So I think to answer your question, really, predominantly is the pressure plate for us, and they were just employed differently. Depending on where we're at. So in the green zones, both north and south, you'd see the pressure plate usually around the home, the compound. They have some in some trails, but quite often we referred to it as like their home protection shotgun. We weren't 100% sure if it was meant out there just for us or maybe some of the locals were putting out there for the Taliban too. I don't know. We'd find them in great numbers inside the compounds, which, you know, it's kind of crazy. They have kids running around there, but I guess you live, you know, where you're allowed to go and not go. And we did, you know, so, a lot of them in the compounds in the group. In the urban area, they were extremely advanced. There's still pressure plates by and large, but they would set them up in ways that would, they would plan on us getting canalized or coming through a certain area. Their goal would be to make, you know, cause one casualty, and then they would plant a bunch of them where the caddy back would most likely come from and or go. And so that's why we take, you know, with IEDs, we take multiple casualties at a time. Oftentimes, with the pressure plate, they'd put one in an area that would, you know, create the casualty, and then they probably usually count on two or three, sometimes up to seven more within, you know, a 50-meter radius. So as we just moved up to conduct the casualty back or treat the wounded, we just caused more. On the urban side, I'll just give you an example. Like we were talking earlier, we'd find, like, you know, you always hear about the rock lines, you know, like, you know, the enemy will put lines of rocks to warn the locals of what, you know, where not to go. Well, that's an easy one for us too. But what we noticed with them was, they would line the alleys in a way with rocks so that you would go and, you know, as we patrol into an alley that didn't have a rock line. And then you're looking as you're in that alley to your left, and there's an alley with a rock line, and then you look to your right, and there's an alley with a rock line. And then you look to your front, and there's an alley with a rock line. And then you just realize that you walked into the alley they wanted you to, and all other routes into the alley that you're in were blocked, you know, for locals. So, like, you're in a place that you're not supposed to be. They would be able to predict our movement that way, at least early on. We'd usually find, like, a pressure plate in there. And then, you know, wherever usually the route back to a casualty would have a command wire. So someone would be watching where the initial explosion would alert them, right? And they'd know that we have a casualty, or they'd confirm if we had one or not. And then they'd go man the command wire positions. And so as the casualty back's moving in, they'd, you know, try to detonate another one or two, or in one case, I think there was five or six, all set up ready for us. So that's mostly what I saw. RC, we only found one in my area, but I know, or at least I was told in some of the other areas, the RCs were more common. As the deployment went on, pressure plates, you know, they were non-discriminate. So the, you know, once they put them in the ground, anybody can step on that. And so there's a couple instances when civilians had stepped on the pressure plates and it caused some civilian casualties. And so the enemy decided to, as they're trying to win the population over, just like we were, they switched over, started using more command wires, which was good for us because they're a little easier to find. And usually there's someone to kill on the other end, which is a benefit when dealing in the IED environment, you know.
Okay, just so everybody knows, HME stands for?
Homemade explosives. So
and then RC stands for?
Radio controlled.
Okay, all right, just so everybody understands.
So, yeah, we'd see, so like I know there was some very craftiness stuff in the other AOs. I really can't talk to it because, you know, I personally didn't see it, but I know there was some stuff that they'd float down some of the canals. They'd use, you know, like they'd put on the bridges or tight strings was popular somewhere, or in other parts of the AO, not in mine. My guys, my enemy, were very, very good at, they would do Met TC on us, and they put these things in places that made sense. And you know, in our case, we had seven strikes, so the enemy was successful seven times with their IEDs in place on us. We were successful at finding them almost 70 times, so we were pretty good at finding them. Unfortunately, some steep learning curve along the way, but my Marines, the combat engineers, they were phenomenal with their ability to picture or find deviations in the baseline. Their combat hunter skills were legit, and they say this. They're my heroes. So, I don't know how they did it, but they walked point every day. And 2 inches of baby powder, and we're still able to somehow find, you know, deviations in that. So they were amazing. They're an amazing group of men.
All right, talk to me about how you used EOD and how you dealt with IEDs in your part of the battle space.
Okay, so let's just say we're on a patrol. We see a couple indicators that are indicating IED. You know, that might be an IED up your. Whatever. Hypothetically, we'd halt the patrol. We would gain, you know, basically confirmation when we start interrogating. So we're looking for, you know, at least two signs that are indicating that something's there. Early on, we'd call EOD out, and they were just, you can imagine, I think Sang was declared a minefield. So EODs, they were a hot commodity just like anywhere else, and really hard to get. Plus to do something like you're taught, like the five C's, you know, like to cordon off an IED in the urban area was next to impossible. You're talking, we had to go many blocks around, to prevent, you know, locals from coming in and messing with it, or bad guys from getting in and messing with it or triggering it. And in which time, if we did attempt that, we'd find more. So, we adopted and got it approved that if we, found an IED or enough indicators, we would interrogate it. Ourselves, a combat engineers mostly, and then we carried assault packs, you know, with quarter sticks, C4. We called them drop charges, and we placed those on top, and we called the hire and request their time on target, and basically letting everybody in the AO know you're going to hear an explosion. It's us, okay? And we'd reduce them that way. We'd take pictures of everything and then report back to hire. So we still had to give our reporting, you know, our IDUSO reports, still had to go to hire, still had to give the tentative grids. We had to do the best we could with our versions of post-blast and give up all the information that EOD would ask for. And then if there were any parts left that we could gather, we would bring those back. And we could usually tell if we were right. So sometimes we weren't willing to risk, you know, going up and finger screwing with an IED. So we'd lob a, you know, a drop charge over there, and then you could tell the difference when it explodes. It almost sounds like two quick explosions that kind of confirm for you if you were right. There were other times, so APODs, right? So we use those at range 400, range 410, and our backpacks with our grenades on them. We came up with the idea, like, hey, like, these are obstacles. If we fire an APOB down an alley, if we get lucky enough and one of the grenades lands on top, you know, like, it could blow it. But what we got smart with quick was, you know, just the concussion of the APOBs going off would push the ground down enough to set off secondary explosions. And so that was kind of our go-to there for a while, too. We'd see an alley that had you've probably seen in that slideshow, but there are alleys where there's just indicators everywhere, and there's no chance in hell we're going down there, but there's times when you have to if you're trying to maneuver an enemy. So we would launch an APOB down an alley and let that explode, and you could watch IED. I mean, it was a very useful way of reducing IEDs, or at least clearing yourself a path, you know, through an area that was otherwise.
Okay, so the PDF file that you sent that shows these things is included in the post. Tell everybody what they're going to see in there.
Are you talking about the IED turnover?
Yes.
Pictures? Yeah, so I don't know if that went through well. What I had in the PowerPoint was comments at the bottom, but basically that was my turnover to the lieutenant who took over from me once we ripped out. So I wanted him to know the different areas, because it took us some time to figure out, hey, this is a good alley and this is a bad alley. And so what they'll see in there is pictures of, you know, pictures of areas that, like at least in the beginning of the slides, the first few pictures are pictures of areas that would concern you. But we found that those were normal. And after, you know, a month or two there, and like, things that you were taught that you should worry about, you know, we weren't worried about. But then, as the slide deck goes further, it shows you things that you should pay attention to and basically how to deal with it. But I don't think the, you know, like in PowerPoint, when at the bottom you can write notes, I don't know if those came through.
No, they don't. They don't come through in a PDF. But what everybody will get is a sense of is the areas through which you patrolled on a daily basis, and,
right, yeah.
and the difference between what you call the brown zone and the difference between the green zone, and the brown zone, very tight, the walls, you know, hugely thick, and that area. So, no, it's a great little piece that, I hope everybody that's listening, just check it out. You'll see it in the post. And all you got to do is click on it, and it's a very interesting little kind of pictorial walk through, you know, Captain Patterson's AO when he was a lieutenant. Talk to me about supporting arms. How did you guys use supporting arms in the AO? And start with organic, and then we'll migrate to air.
Okay, so. You know, basically, I had my platoon, so we could, you know, I had a rifle platoon, but I think it'd be important to state that I forgot to state earlier was I was reinforced with a lot of stuff and people. So I had a sniper team attached. You know, we had EOD from time to time. I had an engineer squad. So anyway, with my ANA attachments and all, I was about 137 Marines, ANA soldiers. corpsmen. So we were large. It allowed us to mass larger squads out outside the line. But with all that, we had a standard mix of 203s, grenades, that sort of stuff. Smalls were a rocket. Smalls and Laws were rockets of choice. I'd get Cat out there a bit, every now and then with javelins. And then I had my own Mark 19s and 50 cals on my vehicles. I had four vehicles, so that was nice too. And then I had one mortar tube. So that was, start talking about fire support, indirect fire-wise. Direct fire-wise, I was covered, no problem. And my patrol base was elevated, so I can overlook almost the entirety of the northern green zone portion of my AO. And I could almost affect all of it with the match range of my weapon system. So that was a benefit. Mortars, I had one mortar tube and some mortarmen, some of the best mortarmen I think the Marine Corps has probably ever seen. I had Sergeant Velasco, but and my one mortar tube, but the approval for that rested with the coping commander, as you'd expect. The only problem with that was is that the company was located at Bob Jackson, which, by vehicle, probably about a 15-minute drive, several clicks away. Not a problem. In hindsight, it was the correct call. Not probably. It was the correct call to have it rest with the company commander. I wanted approval of my own 60s.
Right.
But I didn't have essay of what air was on station and when it was on station and where it was checking in, because air was on station constantly. So, if I was going to approve my own mortars and I had no essay on, what aviation was out there, then that could have been a problem. So,
unless he ascribed to the big sky little bullet theorem, in which he would say, go ahead, Joe, let it rip. What are the odds?
Yeah, there were a few times when, some stuff was going down and I knew things were safe, and I let him know basically we were firing. I'll get my butt chewed a little bit later. We were firing and it was needed. But for the most part, and my company commander is very understanding. He was probably the calmest person that you can imagine, given the chaos of a deployment where, you've got one platoon that's pushed out into, nomadville out there in the middle of nowhere. But he did a good job at keeping those on point. And generally speaking, to be honest, if I needed mortars, they could grab me air. I didn't have to wait much longer.
Right.
It feels like an eternity when you're getting shot, right?
But, right.
When you actually look at the time stamp on it, it's not. Air was on station, I can't think of a time when we didn't divert some sort of indirect to get air.
Okay, did you have a favorite? Did you have a favorite relative to air platforms that you used? What gave you the greatest source of comfort when you knew it was either on station or in the vicinity?
If I knew Cobras were on station, I was content. Like we were supported. I didn't tell you. We had a B-1 bomber drop in support of company and fly around up there. We've had mixed sections of Cobras and Hueys. We had Apaches on station, A-10 in support, and F-18s. And it's pretty cliche to tell you. I'll give a plug out. The Apaches were legit. They'd stay on station for a while, and they would just hover around and just annihilate stuff. It was great. But to hear the wop-wop-wop of the H-1 Whiskeys and the Hueys and the gals shooting off plus I used to work on those, I told you I was proud of Huey Cobra guy.
little Huey Cobra fetish going. Some of the other things, Harvest Hawk. Was first deployed during your deployment, essentially a Marine Corps ghettoed version, not even close to an AC-130, but it's a C-130 with a pod strapped to the back ramp, and then precision-guided ordnance being shoved out of the back of it. But 8 hours of station time, and the ordnance that it dropped, I think some of the lessons learned from Iraq began to pay off here. Because the ordnance was smaller in size. I want to say there were I wish I could remember what the harvest hawk dropped, but I want to say it was less than 200.
Hellfires.
Yeah, I mean, it's a small signature relative to the 500 or 1,000-pound bombs that a lot of times aviation ordnance is, because you simply can't use that in proximity to people. It's just too big. It's too much. But if you have a smaller piece of ordnance, you could drop it in a compound and know that it's not going to impact really the compound next to it. And so talk about did you have a chance to use Harvest Hawk pretty much? The other thing that's awesome about Harvest Hawk is that the munition flies subsonic, which means there is no noise. So when you hear, like, stuff on TV, when you hear that, that is the round slowing down, but the noise continuing to move faster than the round, and so it gets to your ear before the piece of ordnance does. The beauty of the Harvest Hawk is it's quiet, and they're standing there, and the next thing, boom, out go the lights. So it's a beautiful thing. So did you ever have a chance to employ it?
Yes. In fact, for the op that I was talking about yesterday, I'm 90% sure that's what employed the shot force, the Hellfire at the inner tube. But at least that's what I was told. I didn't see where it came from, so I'm guessing it was it. And then based on the video, but I will say one of the most frustrating things was, I didn't care for Hellfire missiles. That was kind of the weapon of choice. I just said, like, I like when they use these Cobras and shit up. I didn't care for the Hellfire because you'd hear it, engage off the wing or however it fires, like it drop and then you hear a boom and then boom. So you hear two booms. And you could, the insurgents knew that too. They see a Cobra on station, they're watching it. Even while they're putting an IV in, they're watching it. And then they hear the first boom, they can run. And we'd miss. They'd miss all the time. So the gun runs were the best. But yes, the Harvest Hawk, I think it was January 17th, that's what fired for us. And that's what made it awesome was, you didn't hear it. It just
showed up. Immaterialized.
Yeah, it showed up. It showed up. And I didn't even know the guy was on station, so it was that quiet. And after all we had Cobras and Hueys and I think an Apache section both that day doing overlap cast support for us. And then those checked off about the time that we were conducting that pivot and clearing. And that's when I got told to stay east of one of the eastings there. And that's when basically we ended the insurgency in my portion of the green zone with that one drop.
And you're gonna hear. Joe said we talked about it yesterday. We recorded it yesterday, so you're gonna hear it coming up next in terms of just so you don't get confused. All right, just so.
Okay.
One more piece of how about artillery? Did you use it? Was it effective? Talk about clearing it too.
Yeah. So yes, Excalibur rounds for the GPS guided artillery rounds. That was kind of the munition of choice. Low collateral damage requires very accurate target location on our part, which that has to come from a higher source. I mean, possess the ability to pull. The target location is accurate as what's required. So, but Excalibur rounds land on a 10-digit grid, and they were at the beginning of deployment. It took some time to get from shot to or actually just to get them to stay shot. It took some time, and then time of flight was expensive. But as the deployment moved on, we killed a lot of guys at the Excalibur round. So that. If I could get that, I at times preferred it over some of the air because there was you didn't hear it coming. I could keep eyes on an enemy, request a mission. That mission would come in without alerting the guys I'm watching. And then the next thing they'd have a VT explode over their head, and it was a good day.
Yeah.
We used HIMARS.
Good night, Prince. The biggest issue is the target dynamic? Is it moving? If it's not moving, then you can work Excal and HIMARS because they do take, because of their the altitude they go to, You know, you have to clear commercial aviation over the battle space, and that's how high stuff goes to. And
right.
and it'll, you know, it's amazing in terms of how accurate it is. It's precision-guided munitions and extended range too. So, but the problem is, do you have the time? And is the target dynamic? Because if the target keeps moving, it's a nightmare. Because every time you refine the max sword and the trajectory, you got to re-clear it, and it could be a nightmare, frustrating. And that's why, you know, sometimes aviation, the most timely, not always the best, because as Joe said, you know, they hear it coming and they react to it, and so it's not as effective. But you can see and so these are all choices in terms of weaponeering that go on a daily basis, multiple times a day. How are we going to prosecute the target to be most responsive and most lethal? And you can see that it's not the same choice every day. It's always a little bit different.
Yeah, what wound up working for us well, there was a taste of this in the operation that we discussed, but what we figured out worked real well is I would get into contact, or whether it was planned mission or, you know, a response to an ambush. I would get into contact and report that to the company, right? So I'm far removed conducting independent distributed ops. I've got to get that information when I'm in contact, pushed up to the company, which is several clicks away. Now, once I get that up to them, generally I'm just feeding them information, and what would happen was the company COC would kind of jump to life. They'd start working the ISR. They'd start finding out and working which firing agencies would be best to use in that particular situation. And then I get a call from the company commander while in contact, like, hey, I've got air, it's going to be checking in a couple minutes. I've got an X-Cal round that I can put on them, you know, right now. What do you want to do? And then, you know, like, a lot of times it's like a selector. I'll take the X-Cal. And I think of one night we were engaged pretty heavy, and I got the call from the CO saying, hey, he's going to put an X-Cal round on the target location of the enemy. I need to confirm it. So I asked if I could put mortars on the target, and basically hit the target with mortars to keep the enemy from escaping. So basically contain using 60s, because they were locked down inside a compound shooting at us from Myrtle. And so this was a perfect example of great teamwork that we had at India Company. I used the 60mm mortars, adjusted them at night onto an objective or onto the target. That kept them in the building while we worked the X-Cal mission, you know, confirmed the grids, and then dropped the X-Cal right smack in the center of that bad boy. And that was a good night. So that's just one example. But a counter example was, you know, I had a pre-planned target for artillery. We were going to go do this mission and try to bait the enemy into occupying this known firing position. They always shot at us from the same place. And so we were going to bait them into there and then an artillery round on it. And it took me 3 days to do this. But on November 10th, like I think we talked briefly yesterday about it, November 10th, they took the bait. And I got diverted from using an artillery mission because air checked in on station. So that was extremely frustrating. Yeah, so I really wanted to put an army round there. But all it required us to do was, we had to stay in the fight a little bit longer. The squad leader had specific orders, you know, like, do not overwhelm the enemy with firepower. That was my orders to him. I need you to keep him engaged. I want him to think he's winning, so he continues to reinforce and continues to reinforce his mass inside that firing point. And the squad leader did as he was asked to do, and
which is not easy, you know.
Your
instinct... When there's real lead flying through the air, is A, you're pissed because they're trying to kill us, and so your instinct is to kill them. And it takes great skill and restraint and discipline as a unit to do missions like that. So, wow.
Yeah, and he did a fantastic job. He was, we had snipers, they were shooting a sasser every, you know, few minutes through a murder hole, so they're kind of keeping them at bay there to kind of keep overwatching. They were also our observers. And then we had the squad down on the deck. It was newly promoted Sergeant Freddy Torres. I mean, he was a sergeant all of 3 days, and that was his first mission. And he was communicating on the radio perfectly. You can hear, I mean, we can all, I wasn't with him. You could hear the gun battle going, and you can, you know, tell the difference between the AKs and the M4s and everything. And the enemy really thought they were winning until the CO got the SA team, finally to check in, identify the target. We tried to mark with smoke, and, one of, our tour guys hit an insurgent with the 203 smoke round. That's great. And so the pilot, said, you know, we're marking as a target with dead bodies. He's coming in, and he dropped a 500-pounder right on top of him. And it was another great day. That was on the, you know, Marine Corps birthday.
Nice. Pretty cool. Yeah, happy birthday. All right, Joe, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into the specifics of our battle study. More on All Marine Radio coming up next.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Study today, we're talking about 3-5's deployment to Sangin in 2010-2011. Gracious enough to join us is Captain Joe Patterson, United States Marine Corps, has done a couple tours as an infantry officer, a platoon commander, and company commander with 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine. So, dark horse to the Corps. And so, Joe, once again, appreciate you doing it, doing this, and let's talk about the specific situation surrounding 1st Platoon on January 16 and 17. So talk to us about what was going on then, and then we'll kind of walk through you guys, your actions.
Okay. Yeah, it's 3rd Platoon, by the way.
I knew third. That. I was just making sure. I was just making sure that you knew that.
Right on. Yeah, so I guess by January, we'd been at our patrol base for a little bit. We'd done a couple ops, both in the green zone and outside into the brown zone area. Up to this point, we had learned a lot of lessons, I think. We learned a lot about the enemy. Fortunately, that came at a cost, you know. I think up to this point in the deployment, I think I was up to 21 casualties, combat wounded, with 2 KIA. One Marine and one Terp up to this point. So we had suffered some losses, and to be honest, we're kind of screwing around. There was the ANA, Afghan National Army advisor, lived on my patrol base with me. His name was Lieutenant Kakis. He and I brainstormed an idea. He said his soldiers were ready to kind of get out there and be in the front, you know, like, that was kind of the idea, was to get the Afghan soldiers leading and get them out in front. And he felt like they had enough training and they were ready to kind of assume a main effort kind of role, which worked out good for us because I had, we'd been putting together an operation, a platoon op to clear Route Triumph. So on the map there, I've got it outlined in white, but essentially it's the primary, ground line of communication that runs from 611 up to the Helmand River. And so it really kind of cuts the northern green zone in half. And we'd only been up to, I think, probably 400 meters up the road. That's about as far as we had gotten. And the reason why was I'd always told the boys, we're not going to get out and get distance unless I can conduct a ground CASIVAC. If I can't do a ground CASIVAC, then we're not going to go that far until we can do a ground CASIVAC. So the idea here was like, you know, we would sequentially clear through the green zone and open up, you know, secure different villages and different areas that get them at least friendly to us so that we could use their routes, and I knew the routes we can get IED. So up to this point, we were only up to about 400 meters out, and so it was time to bring it home. And so we had Company K, 3rd Platoon, a buddy of mine, Lieutenant Tom Schumann, was going to be doing a patrol from Kilo Zeta, which is to our north, east. And what he was going to do is basically patrol along the Helmand River and then hook back to his, company AO. And what we thought would happen would be, the enemy, he'd get engaged with the enemy, we'd get to identify firing positions, and then they'd probably follow him back, and that would expose like a flank to us. So if you imagine we were like 90 degrees offset, and my patrol base was on a extremely elevated, so I could see the entire Northern Green Zone, and so we had overwatch for him. So he did that on the 16th, and the plan worked. So he got himself in some pretty good contact, and he basically did like a fighting withdrawal back to Kilo Company's AO, and we watched. It was interesting to kind of watch the enemy come out and just follow him back. Whether they were doing it shooting or doing it, you know, the motorcycles, and you could just see the little messengers moving back and forth. You could almost make out what looked like a, you know, a platoon online. And so that kind of fit the plan for us. Our goal was to leave at 05 the next morning under darkness and get off to the enemy's right flank and then clear up into what I have on the map there is like the circles, like a platoon objective. The idea was to get up to that objective and clear it because we believed that that's where their training camps were, that's where their IED making facilities were, and that was where they felt safe. And it was no longer good to feel safe and saying with Marines there. So that's why we put the plan together.
Okay, so let me ask you about some of the markers on your map. The red markers on your map denote what?
Red marks are enemy teams, so 2 to 4 guys. And this is off my memory. This is scientific.
Okay.
There was about a platoon plus up there that was operating enemy wise.
Okay. All right. So every place you see a red diamond, you're going to see some team of bad guy.
Correct. Yeah, that's where they at least when they hit the go button or start button. It's my belief on where bad guys started from.
All right. Walk us through. So, let's see. 3rd Platoon from Kilo Company, they do their thing. You essentially are watching your adversary respond to him, both offensively and defensively. And then what?
So what that really allowed us to do is we observed. We weren't in a position where we could support with fire due to range. But what it allowed us to do is we got to see where the enemy sortie out of. So, you know, where are the places they constantly go to and from a lot, grab weapons and whatever. And where do they come back to when they're done? And that gave us our target locations for the next stop. So that happens on the 16th. And then what we do is we set up for the 17th. So this isn't a like a knee-jerk thing. I had requested that CAT comes out, our combined anti-armor team, come out and support us with some machine gun and saber bics. And then I'd also asked, you know, building a fire support plan based pretty much on air with the company. So before we stepped, what I had set up was three CAT vehicles, all MATVs. There's a Mark, a 50 cal, and a tow. And then I had pre-planned air on station for the duration of pretty much the day that I assumed that we'd be clearing. And it was all approved and good to go. And the plan was 05, the vehicles would depart, and they'd get up Route Triumph and kind of screen for us. And that's where we started. So right around the early morning time, CAT goes out. And then we follow behind and start getting into the green zone. The idea would be that the ANA, they put together about 2 squads, and they were going to go basically clear Route Triumph. So when I say clear, I mean adjacent houses, but predominantly the road, like making sure there's no IEDs on the road. And so they were going to be the main effort kind of up the middle. What we were going to do was I was going to have a squad on their left flank, slightly forward of them, and then a squad on their right flank slightly forward of them. So if you imagine a V, so it's like a V formation, platoon size, clearing through the Northern Green Zone. So as soon as we depart clearing lines in the morning, there's a convoy. So there's like a mark on there, I think, at number 1 somewhere. There's a convoy that did not call into our AO and they roll right through us with all their lights on. So we're trying to get out into the green zone, without being seen and before sun comes up, because our patrol base was so elevated that anytime we'd leave friendly lines, you know, everybody in the world would see it. So we wanted them to wake up, and then we're, you know, right there, kind of like a shock and awe factor a little bit, and then make them respond to that. That didn't work because the convoy rolling through attracted a lot of attention, being that they're noisy and they had lights, and so that alerted people that something big was going on, and then also alerted them to there we are in the cornfield. So plan didn't work. ANA got impatient, pushed a little bit past the CAT vehicle who was trying to cross a real small bridge on Route Triumph. The bridge did not hold, and the CAT vehicle rolled over in the water. So decision point one for me, right? I'm on the right side, the right flank of the ANA platoon or ANA squads. And we've already been compromised, both visually and audibly. And now I've got a vehicle rollover into the water. The driver, A driver, everybody says they're okay. They're going to get a wrecker to come out and pull it out. But now security is going to be required. My answer here is the best security they're going to have is us to continue the mission. So I left overwatch on it from the patrol base, and we continue to clear, to the north. So that was like the big thing. As we're dealing with the CAT vehicle situation, that's basically the ANA got real impatient, and they were ready to, you know, they wanted to attack. They wanted to be the main effort. But mind you, we haven't been in contact yet. So that didn't last long. We crossed, what I have down there is phase line red, and the ANA walked right into an ambush. They had to take cover and, return fire as best they could. But the V formation that we were operating in wasn't the V anymore, it was like a backwards V, because they got out ahead of us too far. So we took a tactical halt, the air checks on station, air starts identifying targets. So this is like when we were talking about at the beginning, how they like to mass on you. So, this is a perfect example of that. So ANA is engaged. We're not engaged yet. Don't know for sure if they know exactly where all the U.S. forces are. But air checks in, and they start to prosecute targets. So on your image, you know, you can see some of the targets that air started to prosecute. If I remember right, the first thing that checked in was a section of Cobras. And so what was unique about this, and frustrating for me, but also kind of nice now that I'm thinking back about it, you know, as an infantry lieutenant, you want all the power in the world. Well, the air that checked in on station, I'm not controlling that. That's being controlled by a JTAC at Bob Jackson, who's controlling them Type 2. So he's watching things on a blimp. He's watching things on ISR imagery coming in, and he's identifying targets, and he's prosecuting them with the aircraft that check on station. So the way that we had to deconflict that is make sure that I'm south of, you know, the phase lines that I put up here, or south of certain northings, to make sure that he can run the attack aircraft in without any interference with me at all. So kind of frustrating. It slows us down a little bit, but it also gave me the opportunity to not be completely focused on everything going on in the air. I got to move the squads around and position those pieces right. So that was the first bit.
A busy morning, right?
Yeah, busy morning.
Talk about an understatement, right? A busy morning, right? If you could imagine. I mean, we talk about friction, right, in war. Talk about friction in combat, and this is it personified, right? You have this whole thing planned. Everybody's ready to go, and all of a sudden you see headlights. What the hell is that? Yeah, and it's some transcom, right, sustainment convoy that's headed to Fob Delaram or the Kajaki Dam or some other bullshit, and you're like, what? What is going on? Right? And
I was so pissed. I can't even tell you how pissed off I was.
No.
I was very, very angry.
You know, it's interesting because running, you know, a combat operations center, part of our, you know, operations brief that we did every day was published, you know,
who was coming through, civilian and the military convoys that were coming through, and making sure that everybody knew that stuff and pushing it out there. And I remember somebody one day saying, why do you do this? I said, because they have to have this data just for what they do on a daily basis. Okay, they've got to know. Right? Now, I'm not saying that there won't be surprises because, you know, stuff does get screwed up. But in 2004 in Iraq, when we weren't deliberate about convoys and things like that, people got killed. You know, convoy rolling in through Jordan that nobody knows, rolling through Al Anbar, nobody knows about it. Right? And all of a sudden one truck comes blowing into a firm base. Hey, what's going on? And you have one soldier truck driver with an Iridium saying, hey, man, there's four trucks out on that road getting shot up. What are you talking about? We don't know anything about it. And it was not good. And so, and the reason why you did it was exactly these reasons. Right? Because people put their lives on the line, and you can't have, you know, some truck driver, you know, driving through with his Walkman on going, what the hell? Where's the Kentucky Dam? Is it around here? No, idiot. Right? Anyway. All right. But again, you make the, you and I, a week ago, had a conversation about task saturation.
Yep.
You're trying to control movement. You're coordinating with the ANA. You got an eye on fire support. You got a vehicle recovery going on. And again, what's the worry about the vehicle recovery? The longer those guys stay there, at some point they're going to get ambushed. They're going to get hit. And so all those things are going through your first lieutenant head, and in the midst of this operation that you're continuing. Yes.
Yes, and you know, like the big overarching kind of factor to me is, I don't know if this will come out right, but it's perception. So the perception that they had on the Brits, for example, is when they would get in contact, they would run away. Now that's not what happened, right?
Right.
But you know, they would get in contact, they would deal with the contact. And then the contact would end, and they'd have to go back to their patrol base. And we've heard that constantly from the locals that, you know, the Brits would get in contact and they'd run away. And they really liked how the Marines would not run away. And so my decisions, at least in this first portion, right, so the first thing that I was worried about was, okay, is the bridge still intact? Because if it's not, I can't ground cast it back to my guys. If something happens further north.
Okay. And
that might have put a stop.
Show us on the bridge. Show us on the map. Which bridge are you talking about?
So if you are looking at my patrol base.
Right.
Which is, you know, the ops terms and graphic for 3rd Platoon, India 5. And
right.
You go just a little bit to the north on Mount Trent. There's a triangle with a number 2 on it.
Yes. That's a bridge.
There's a bridge right there. And it crosses a canal. Like a real small canal, but it crosses a canal. And if there's no getting, you know, that canal is not crossable without that bridge. We had brought out some engineers about a week prior and did a survey on it to make sure, like, hey, this thing will hold the weight and this will hold it, you know, like it'll fit an MRAP on there, no problem. So it's like we did the homework. But when the driver pulled up, he kind of hugged the right side of it a little bit too much. And a little piece of the road gave, and it put him right in the drink. But lucky, it wasn't a deep one, so, you know, they're all good. But that was my decision, I can't, if this bridge isn't intact, I can't catch it back via ground. And there's no air, the air medevac guys were, you know, like Dustoff and Pedro, those guys are amazing. They'll land wherever. But the thought of, like, I know we're going to be in some serious contact soon, it's better, the way we chose to do it is ground CASIVAC our guys to an LZ, that's secured far away. Because generally we can ground CASIVAC them, get them to Fob Jackson before the aircraft's on the deck. So that was always my go-to was if I can get my casualty to Fob Jackson before the medevac's on station, then that's a win. And if I couldn't do that, then I would look at, you know, landing a bird in an LZ somewhere close by, but then they're probably going to come under fire pretty quick. So that bridge was huge. So it turned out vehicle rolled over. We're not going to sit. Sorry, go ahead.
No, just a comment on, you know, Joe and I were there at the same time, and those guys, those Army guys who flew those dust-off missions, their CO was a former Ranger, and those guys were ballsy. They were ballsy pilots. And if, you know, a lot of times, you know, you'd hold them outside of an LZ trying to cool the LZ out. But if the guy in there was crashing, you know, if the Marine in there was crashing and you told him he's crashing, he's gonna die, they would nose down, man. They'd go right in there. They were, I mean, I'll tell you what, eternal respect
for
those guys.
I've seen them clip C-wire coming in, you know, like coming in so fast. Like, they're my heroes. They're awesome. Awesome
yeah.
dudes.
Okay. No doubt.
But yeah, that was my big decision there was, okay, so now I can't, now I know I can't get our U.S. vehicles on that road, and I can't ground casualty back with my stuff. But we do have the ANA, they drive Ford Rangers, no problem. So now we just switched to our alternate, you know, casualty back means, which is the Ford Ranger. We'll just put the litter in the back of a Ford Ranger and drive it that way. So in my head, I'm going, okay, green light. We also, the contact up to, you know, that first contact wasn't bad. Air is basically doing, everything that I want them to do. So the company's working for me. They're looking deep while I have close. So they're looking deep and they're watching any enemy movement out of those firing points that we identified the day prior, coming out. If they ID weapons, the covers were going on them. So, that's what was happening. So, like the entire, so that allowed me to slow my movement a little bit, be a little bit more deliberate, and take less risk with the IED threat. So we're moving first contact down. We cross phase line white. ANA are making, they're not understanding that they're on a road, so they're able to move a little faster than us. So they kept ahead of us. I wasn't happy with the formation at any point. It was very frustrating for me. And then, you know, you got the, I've got a U.S. Marine lieutenant with them who's also frustrated with them. So it was interesting, you know, conversations as we move along. But as we're moving, they get close to phase line white. And almost at the exact same time, they, the ANA, I'm talking again, they walk into what we believe was a U-shaped ambush. So they've taken contact from direct front and direct left. And they're in a pretty open area on the road, but they were able to basically lay down on the gravel and find some cover behind a couple walls. So now I'm hearing the battle go down. At the same time, I take one round by my left ear. The sniper located direct front somewhere. Took one shot. I don't know how close it came, but it was close enough to make me eat dirt pretty quick, and it missed the guy behind me. I think it got even closer to him. So, you know, decision time again. Got a sniper. I think he's direct front. I've got an NA squad pinned down, and I've got a free squad on their left flank. So that the left flank squad leader moves into a position to try to help out and get the U-shaped ambush to look less like a U and more like an I. So he does that. At the same time, Lieutenant Cactus calls me and asks me if I can do an action right. They'll suppress the enemy with the support by fire, and I'll basically sweep through and hit them on the flank. All the time, meanwhile, while that's all going on, the company's talking to my radio operator, talking about how they're watching reinforcements come from both the southwest and southwest and north, and they're prosecuting those. So that's all going on. We push through with a sniper threat. We didn't take any more fire. And this is where it gets a little, interesting here. As I get close to phase line white, Lieutenant Cactus says, hey, he's going to be able to suppress, he's still stuck in the kill zone. He's going to be able to suppress and allow me to maneuver, on the enemy's left flank. So I hear the suppression pick up. I can't see, where they're shooting. I can only hear. He says, hey, we've got effective suppression. So we pick the squad up, and we go to cross a road to conduct this action right. And as I'm crossing the road, we're throwing smoke. You know what I mean? We're trying to secure our movement as best we can. As I'm crossing the road, and I look over to where the Afghan support by fire position is supposed to be, I see Afghans all shooting in the sky. Right? They're making a lot of noise. but they're not suppressing anything. And at about that moment, we come under heavy, heavy contact. So we're just in a dead sprint towards the objective now. Rounds are hitting the wall in front of me, behind me. I don't know how. We didn't take any. No one got hit. It was amazing. At that point, Lieutenant Kakis realizes what's going on. He gets some of his guys into a building, and they're able to actually provide some suppression for us. And then first squad on their left flank was able to get some suppression. We wound up clearing through all the way over to Phase Line Blue. And then somehow no one got hurt. So then we get a call on the radio saying, hey, like we were doing something right because the enemy started running a bunch of Kazibaks. So they were Kazibaking a bunch of guys, and Cobras were prosecuting targets as they were, you know, trying to grab the casualties, RPGs, and whatever. And then I got told I needed to stay. I put a Phase Line Blue down on the map.
Joe, let me stop you. Describe a Kazivac done by the insurgents in Afghanistan. What did that look like?
I could only tell you fast. That's about as best as I could get. I never once saw a Kazivac done by them. I know we shot, like I could, like I knew when I shot somebody, and then we go right there and they're gone, right? So we hear it off ISR all the time. I've seen it on some of the ISR feeds, but it looks a lot like our Kazivac. But they don't. Early on, they would grab weapons, and if they grab weapons, we're clear not to engage them. As soon as they left weapons on the ground and they start Kazivacking, we can't engage them. And so that's what we were seeing a lot. On this day, they initially were trying to bring RPGs and some of the better weapons with them when they were doing the Kazivac. But, they learned quickly just to leave those. But what was, okay, so.
Let me just add to that, as somebody who watched him a lot, because we were not, you know, we could smoke them in a vehicle. We just had to maintain positive identification. So, and what Joe says is absolutely right. Fast, they would drag it either in a wheelbarrow, toss them over a motorcycle, whoever they were trying to medevac, to get them out of the general vicinity of where Marines were. Then another car would pull up, and they would throw them in the back seat. They'd throw them in the trunk, and that car would literally take off through the desert and or get to the desert as quick as they can, and then another car would meet them someplace. And it was amazing to watch, and I saw it a lot. And then now you've changed vehicles twice, and now you're doubling back to head to some doctor's place. And then so you really what you're trying to do is you're trying to, you know, you build your own, you know, intelligence on what how they do it. And pretty soon they would meet up with a doctor at some house, and then you'd go coordinate and search the house and yoke everybody up. And so, but I will just tell you, I mean, they were pretty impressive in terms of getting their guys out of there. Pretty impressive.
It was amazing.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And again, using all those things, wheelbarrows, motorcycles, cars, and as Joe said, going fast. All right, keep going. So then what happens? So now we're on the next map as you guys pivot, right? You guys have pivoted and what is that? So third squad is hooking towards the objective. You have contact short of Phase Line Blue. Yes?
Yeah, so that the contact short of Phase Line Blue is so the U-shaped ambush that the ANA walked in on, and this was all discovered and debriefed later, but
right.
They had about 8 or 9 guys there with machine guns and RPGs. They didn't fire an RPG, but what was interesting was they had an IED right smack in the middle of Triumph and where I put Phase Line White there. And it was a command wire. And so they initiated the ambush a little bit too early. Because if they would have waited, you know, we would have been on top of an IED. It could have been an IED initiated ambush and what have you. But we had a combat engineer, U.S. Marine, with the ANA. So we had about, I think I had 6 Marines with the ANA that were stuck in this ambush that was going on. And so I say all that to say this, like the fact that the ANA got out in front and screwed up my formation actually worked out to our favor. So this was like one of those blessings in disguise because they baited this ambush and the enemy took the bait so well that they committed. And when they committed to the ambush, it left them open for first squad on their left to help them out. But I had Lance Corporal Stengel, who was my combat engineer, he's the number one guy in the road that walks into the U-shaped position. Contact happened, and there was literally an enemy that popped up about 10 feet in front of a wall that was hiding behind a wall and started shooting him. And he had his metal detector, and he threw the metal detector like a Spartan would throw a spear. Right, this guy. So the only piece of gear I lost in the entire deployment was the metal detector that my Lance Corporal threw as a weapon to the bad guys. They wound up keeping it and running away with it. It was one of those combat loss investigation things. But anyway, long story short,
bottom line is that's a pretty short investigation, though, yes. It's one statement.
Live with that. I kept the written statement. It's in my cool things I have, folder. I have it still. It's pretty awesome. But he was actually when we did the Operation Dark Horse One, when I was telling you we were in the alley, and the guy showed up on the other end and shot machine gun down at all of us. Fiction moment.
Right.
He was one of the guys who was shot. I said it was the luckiest day of my life. He was one of the ones in front of me who was shot, but he was shot in the mouth and it went out his cheek. So the only wound he had was he was shot in the face, but it literally just was like a in and out of his cheek. Crazy, right? So he shows back up after getting that stitched up and goes through this, throws his metal detector like a spear. Long story short, Lance Corporal with the Bronze Star for just being badass
and
awesome.
And a Purple Heart. That's got to be a great story.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, and for people, you're moving, and somehow or other this round goes through your cheek. And they stitch you up and you come back. That's
the craziest caddy badge.
That's the craziest. You see the craziest shit you've ever seen. Like what? Out of that explosion, like nobody's injured and this, that, and the other thing. Yep. Like, whatever, man.
Crazy.
Yeah, literally, it's crazy. And when you hear that story, that is crazy. Because there's no way you could ever try to do that and you could do it. No way.
Yeah. Right.
Right? Yet it happens. So, all right, keep going, Joe.
So, you talked about CASVAC earlier. So where we're at now is we've kind of cleared through, we're speed clearing through the compounds now. So initially it was to go in there and do like a detailed clear, search everything, TSE, the whole nine. But now that contacts, going and we've got them. They're basically withdrawing at this point, and we've got air striking them, deep. So everything's working out. We're just like, well, let's just keep killing them, and then we'll come back and back clear, and find everything there. And so I get a call as we're moving. So now we're in like the slums. I mean, this is like where we're at now up by the Helmand River. This is really the most intimidating, terrifying terrain that I saw when I was in Sangin. It was like rubble, everything's dirty. There's no clear paths to anything, which means like IEDs could literally be anywhere. It was, no money had made it back there. It's real, it was felt like kind of, you're in a criminal area and it's obvious. And so you knew like most of the people there, there was no kids, there was no women, there was no, it was just men shooting at you and withdrawing back. So we found like some sort of headquarters area is what I'm getting at. And I get a call from my CEO saying, hey, look, they're running CASVACs. We're going to continue to watch because it seems like one of the Cobras had blown one of the guy's legs off. And they're trying to, for whatever reason, the entire group of bad guys that was shooting at us is now focused on CASVACing this one dude. So maybe this one dude is important. So we're going to watch and see kind of how this plays out. And so here was their CASVAC plan.
So
here's a new one for you.
Are they, and they're taking this guy across the river?
Yeah. So what their plan is, they have an inner tube.
I watched it.
An inner tube. You saw this?
I was watching it live.
Yeah, there. Then you know exactly what happens.
Well,
so, yeah, they're pumping the
thing. You'll tell everybody, but this guy was not in good shape.
Nope.
Yeah.
So they're pumping the inner tube up, like taking shifts on it, pumping like you're pumping a bicycle, you know, tire up as fast as you can go. And the only way I know all this is because I have now seen the video of this thing, and anyway, it makes my day because now I'm not getting shot at anymore. We're going clear. I'm hearing my CO telling me they're watching this thing go down. They're going to prosecute. I need to stay east of some easting, and they'll take care of it. And just be prepared to go do the BDA once it's all done. And so, long story short, there's 7-8 guys roughly around the inner tube, and I believe it was a harvest hawk. It was a hellfire that hit dead center of the inner tube and knocked them all out. Killed all of them except one.
And punctured the inner tube, just by the way.
And, yeah. And so what was significant about that is we went back, we did our back clear, our contact's over, op was success. We back cleared, we found what looked like a training camp, like where they had classroom material. We had our turf plot taken a look at a bunch of stuff. We found a ton of IED making materials. We found weapons and you name it. We uncovered something big. We got rid of all of that. And then we went basically back to Phase Line White, where the primary ambush was. Went in and talked to one of the local leaders that owned the house there. And long story short, we brought the second platoon in after about a week, and we never took contact from in my portion of this. We didn't take contact in the Northern Green Zone from January till April when we left. So that was the last fight up there. And the reason I wanted to talk about this one, because this is kind of a great success story. So it's got, we had a lot of friction up front and early. The Marines performed well without any, you know, they took initiative and they had good judgment. We had no civilian interference, no civilian casualties. We killed a bunch of bad guys. We had air. The company was supporting the platoon. We had, you know, another platoon from another company supporting this. It was just a lot of everything kind of going right. We learned from a lot of mistakes early. This op, everything kind of was synchronized well. It worked really well.
Okay, so
and as a result,
in spite of the convoy blowing through, the truck rolling over, the truck rolling off the bridge, Everything worked well, and it ran pretty smooth, and which is important for people to understand, because it doesn't go there on chrome and well lubricated. Okay, it goes there because you stuff it there, right? Because leaders stuff it through, and all these things that happen are things that happen in the midst of it, and it's leaders, it's Marine leaders. From the rank of lance corporal to, you know, in Joe's case, lieutenant, who are there making it happen. Because it doesn't go there on its own. It doesn't go there on its own. So when he talks about it all came together, listen to the friction that you fight through just on this platoon clearing operation. And all the different pieces that go into working with another country's military, right? Working with your own military, aviation, fires, an adjacent unit, and then the thing moves a little bit, and you're adjusting it as you go, to include fighting out of a U-shaped ambush. Hey, all in a day's work, Joe.
Yeah, this was like probably the funnest day that we had, and I think it could have gone sour really, really quick. But I think for the young officer group out there, the young lieutenants and whatever, where I found myself during this was what they always tell you that you should be doing, and I found it very hard to do before this, and that was like I'm thinking three moves ahead. So, you know, the we're compromised early. Okay, what does that mean? you know, the vehicle goes over. What does that mean, and does that detract from anything, or do we just call an audible? And air is striking this. What does that mean? Are they trying to reinforce that 55? You know, so the only reason or way I was able to do that is because I had squad leaders and team leaders that took initiative, and they were, you know, they were just outstanding. At this point in the deployment, they needed zero guidance, and so having my Marines be able to fight without me allowed me to be, you know, a couple steps ahead and keep my brain in the game and not get past saturated. So I think that was the main reason why I wanted to talk through this one, was because, you know, as a young guy, and even the young lieutenants I just had, they want to know how would they perform in combat. And I'm like, well, you'll perform in combat the way you perform on the range and in garrison and the barracks. Discipline is the number one thing that they need, because that you need. You need to have discipline to make sure you're enforcing discipline, right? So it's just, I wouldn't have survived that deployment without the sergeants and corporals that I had, and lance corporals for that matter, that were next to me, and they took ownership of every aspect. They gave orders. They weren't lazy. You know, they gave no shit, like 5-paragraph orders. Fragos, you know, most of the time it's Fragos. They did good in that TC. They did their ammo COAs, and they put a fire support plan together for their squad patrols and ops. They did everything that you'd want your guys to do. They did that. That's because we trained it, and that's important. You're not just going to show up there and do well. You have to do well before you show up there.
All right, Joe, let's just talk about, you just talked about discipline, right? Which it's interesting. I didn't intend for this. I mean, I have my own thoughts on discipline and how important it is, but it's interesting. As the fourth installment of this, everybody talks about discipline and how it's the truth, the light, and the way. If you're not disciplined, you're going to pay. So it's interesting. So that's lesson learned number one. Give me lesson learned number two.
Okay, so I definitely would say discipline would be 1 through 5, but I think, family, I don't know if that's a lesson. We were a family, and I don't know how I think it comes down to maybe team building or whatever, but like these Marines loved each other, and so I think the lesson out of that is like how important being a human being, or being, I don't know how to put that into words. So when we had, I think I was 21 or so casualties, Sergeant Major Bushway came and visited my platoon.
And he is? Was he battalion or regimental?
He was the battalion sergeant major, yeah. And he walked into First Squad's living space and said, "Sir, come here, you gotta see this." I'm like, "What?" I thought, you know, he's gonna be grumpy, or maybe it was that he saw a mess or something, you know.
Exactly.
You know, man. And I go in there, and he's like, "How many casualties you had?" I'm like, 21. It's between 18 and 21 at this point. And he's like, "Look, they didn't spread out." And you'd think, like, as guys get sent home or get wounded, like, they'd spread out and have to have more space. And he pointed out that all their cots were, like, touching each other. He's like, "They want to be near each other." He's like, "You've got a good group here." I'm like, I can't take any credit for that. Like, they're just... If you don't have that, you don't have anything. Because, like, you fight for the ones you love. You know, like, how you explain a guy, you know, ripping the car door off of a burning car to get his kid out of it? Well, you explain it because he's going to do that because he loves what's inside. And if you don't, you're not going to be able to do those things. I don't know. That's how I equate it. But we were – every lieutenant will tell you that the team's the best. We were exceptionally close. And still are. I mean, I still talk to most everybody from that platoon. I mean, we still interact quite a bit. So I think about that.
You know what? Again, I, you know, it's interesting. Same words come up. Jarvis Lynch, Major General, right, talking about LZ Margo last week, said, "This was the best group of Marines that have ever walked through the Marine Corps." Right? And Chris Bronzy, 4 weeks ago, said, "Love is more than an emotion.
it's a responsibility. And so it's interesting that these same words, these same concepts come up in terms of. So when you say he loved his Marines, that means, and I'll quote the division commander of the 1st Marine Division. When I interviewed him, he was in Ramadi with as a battalion commander of 1-5 in 2005. And he said, you know, Mac, my job is to give these guys what they need, not what they want. When they come back from a long day out, what they want to do is throw their gear off, right? Go get something to eat and play video games, right? What do they need? They need to debrief. They need to clean their weapons. They need to clean the cruisers, PM the vehicles, fill sandbags. After that, they need to eat, and then they need to sleep, and I need to supervise that. And so it's interesting in terms of what is love when we go do these things. And trust me, Marines know. Like, they may not want to do that stuff, but when there's incoming rounds and those sandbags are shaving people's asses, they're like, yeah, that sandbag stuff, that's not that bad after all, man. I love these things. You know, and the same thing with when stuff works, because, you know, we're disciplined and we get after cleaning it, and it works on a regular basis, now we get it. You know, left to our own, we may just half-ass it because everybody does want to sleep because you're tired. But it's those kind of things, and it's interesting they come up over and over and over again in these things. So love, and I just called Chris Bronzy on Saturday, or I texted him, hey, where did you get that quote? He said, I heard it in church somewhere. I said, do you have any idea? He said, no. I said, well, that's an awesome quote. You ought to figure it out there. Beavis, and he said, I can't remember, Mac, leave me alone. But it is, love is, especially as a leader, love is more than an emotion, it's a responsibility, and I'll tell you what, it's not going to take your Marines long to figure out, that you give a shit and that you're good by virtue of what you guys do in terms of continuing actions. And I'll tell you, Joe, just to your credit, you get there, and you're supposed to operate, and you say, hey, sir, I need a couple of days to dedicate to force protection because this is not going to work here. This is bad. This is not good. And to his credit, he gives it to you. And I mean, that's not lost on anybody. I mean, you're protecting their lives, and people respect that. Give me another lesson learned.
Oh, let's see. I think trying to find some good wisdom.
I'll tee him up. You hit him. Give me a lesson learned relative to working with a coalition partner, in this case a host nation unit in the ANA.
Yeah, so it's extremely frustrating. it's frustrating because you have what. The communication part is what's hard, I think. You know what you think would work best, and then it takes a little bit of humility to put your thoughts aside and realize, like, hey, maybe they know what's best. You know, like, they live here, they're from here. But then also executing judgment and realizing, well, maybe they don't also. So it was a back-and-forth battle. There were some good ones, there were some bad ones, I think. We probably could have done better planning with them, and keeping them, there was just some lack of trust, back and forth, but,
So is it personality driven in retrospect? Is it, you talk about the constant communication thing with interpreters and things like that. So what did those things make it more challenging? Because I've heard other people say, no, you know, my guy was Lieutenant so-and-so, and he and I hit it off, and it was great. They were good. You know, I mean, they're not Marines, and we know that, you know, but they made progress, and they got to the point where they were willing to mix it up. What advice do you have? Is it personality dependent? Is it, is it more communication? What is it?
I mean, it's a combination of both. I think it takes, on the Marine side, an understanding that, that you may be right all the time, or you may think you're right all the time, but you have to petition you have to partner is, I mean, really what it comes down to. And that's, you know that they're maybe they're offering an idea that's contrary to yours, but you're accepting it anyway to build that kind of, bank of trust. And, you know, like if it works, then, you know, give them the credit. If it doesn't work, then recommend changes. My first batch, so I had two batches of them while I was there. My first batch was outstanding. I loved them. The second batch we got in towards this time period, actually, they were young and inexperienced and very cocky and prideful, as would be in their culture. And then, you know, we didn't know what the cocky, prideful Marines either. So we made it work. And would I do it again? No. but we made it work. Would we have been as successful as we were without them? Also, no. We needed them, and we knew that. They knew that, and that's how it should be, right? So we left. We're not even in Sangin anymore. They are. So hopefully, it's all going well for them.
Now, you know what? When we first got the first guys who would fight in 2004, we did a series of snap BCPs in Iraq, which were really effective. Throughout the AO wide, everybody that could in their AO, they just threw down VCPs and just started checking people. But, you know, we're Americans. What the hell are we looking for, right? We don't know. We have interpreters and, they may not know. But we get these guys and they're standing at these VCPs like smoking cigarettes, right? The guys in the third car yoke them up. Bust up, open this car, money, weapons in it. Like, how do you guys know? Like, come on, man, we're from here. All right, we know. We just know. This is our home. And then they do it like, yeah, that second car, those guys, yank them out. And they walk up and they talk to them for like 30 seconds. Yeah, arrest both of them. And they were bad guys. So there's a lot, it's as frustrating as it can be. Working with host nation forces, is absolutely mandatory. And we never fight now, without them. So it's something that you gotta get good at. And I think, Joe, there's great wisdom in what you say in terms of, hey, you know, you gotta let them do it. You gotta let them, lead. You gotta use their ideas, you know, and that's all part of forging a partnership based on respect. Right? And so, and they will normally be a little bit spring-loaded to be, I think, insulted, you know, if they're put in the follow me always, stay back there, right? We'll take care of this. You guys are just along for the ride. And so you have to be sensitive to all that, you know? You have to be sensitive to all that.
Yeah, for sure.
Talk to me about, give me a lesson learned in this operation relative to fire support.
So in this particular case, fire support was very, it was not passive by any means. So I relied on the company to support me. Now, in this particular, that worked, because I was the only thing on the company's radar, because this was a planned operation, so it wasn't like surprise, we're in contact, we need support. This flexed the company's muscle, pretty good. And, ultimately, I think we were pretty close to outnumbered, when we left, when we LD'd. And the company using phase lines and fire support control measures really, supported us. And so that was good. The, lessons that I had learned, I think, on ops similar to this one is every time you leave the wire, it goes back to discipline. Like, before I send a patrol out, before I go out on patrol myself, you have to do MET T. You have to, most importantly, come out just like you used to teach in IOCD with an ML COA based on phases or parts or whatever the case, stages of this. Where, if I get hit, it's going to be from here. And when I get hit from here, if I take a casualty, I'm going to casualty back them from here. And doing that for, I don't know how many patrols we sent out. I was well over 300 mission numbers before the deployment was over, doing that for every single one of them. Because what that allowed me to do is, say I sent first squad out on a patrol, and I make him do it too. So, hey, if I get hit between here and here, it's going to come from this tree line. And then that would allow my mortarman to put that sending the gun data for his mortar. And then they would get in contact, and all the squad leader would do is verify, yep, hey, I was right, fire target number, whatever, and boom, mortars go downrange fast. So, like, people want to complain about, you know, responsiveness of fire support. I'll tell you, like, they're probably not doing the homework. If you do the homework, you know, we all want to support each other with fire support. Like, so I think the lesson learned there is training, it comes down to discipline, not being lazy. It's just like you said, the division commander said, like, there's things you have to do to show up. And so, like, in our case, like, my guys, they did that every time. They're required to do that before they went out. I would ask them before they went out on patrol, if you get hit between here and here, where is it coming from, do you think? Where are you going to casualty back to take a casualty here or there? And they would always have answers at the ready for that. And then that way, every, like, the COC, sending a squad patrol out was a platoon function. So I had guys on post who would go, you know, would stand to an overwatch. I'd have, before I would clear them to exit friendly lines, my vehicles would already been started up. They'd have all their flak jackets and all their ammo. The PCCs and PCIs of my QRF were done and complete before I would say, you are cleared to exit friendly lines for a foot patrol. So, like, all the functions getting done and not being lazy. So I think I went on, like, three different tangents there.
No, again, these things we all learn. You learn it for a lesson. And the things you hear in the Marine Corps, the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in wartime. There's great wisdom in all that. So, those daily exercising those muscles, you know, going to those going to the mental combat gymnasium before you go out, allows you to envision what you're gonna happen. And even if what happens to you isn't what you thought, it will be normally a variation of that. So adjusting off it is not an issue either. But that mental piece is incredibly important. Any lesson learned in this op relative to casualties and CASVAC?
For this thought, no, we didn't have any, and I think we'd have been fine, because, you know, like, so it's, I don't want to say casualties drove my planning for ops, but I would not approve a mission or a patrol unless we had a primary, alternate, tertiary, like, no kidding, executable casualty plan. And I know, like, that's a no-brainer, right, for anybody who's been to, like...
No, but let me tell you what isn't enough. So you get that, right? Everybody says, oh, yeah, okay. And then we say, yeah, but we really want to get to this area, okay? And we can, you know, if we just extend across the river a little bit, we can cross here, then, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but the casualty, well, you know, we can come close. I think when you're a novice, you say... Okay, it's worth the risk. After you become a professional, what you say is, can't do it.
Right.
Because you can't, good enough isn't good enough. If you're going to ask somebody to bet your life on it, you better be able to save his life. Or else you've failed in your moral obligation to love him and take care of him and to give as much as he's giving. Right, because of some instinct or some reach that you want to make. In combat, it just doesn't work. And I think those of us that have seen it and tried to save guys who were dying and you can't get the medevac in there and you're listening to that, he's crashing on the deck and you're watching Merc chat, right? We brought him back a second time, we need the helo now. I mean, if you've ever participated in something like that, it's horrible. It's horrible, and so that's a professional perspective, huh?
Yeah, and that, unfortunately, that happens. You know, where you have to say no, and that, you know, in this department, they're different. There's times when, you know, you have to say, like, I can't do that. I will go here and here, and then 3 days from now, as I secure these areas, be able to go here and here now. But I can't go right this minute because I can't caddy back these guys in the north or bring them an ammo resupply. Because it goes back to the thing I was talking about earlier with perception. Okay, so if I have to have guys do like a withdraw under pressure to get back to an ammo resupply point, the public's perception of what's happening is they're retreating, right? So, and that's the opposite of what we were trying to do, at least where we were, is we wanted to show, hey, we're going forward. We're not ever going to step backwards. Once we gain ground, we're keeping it. And so it's the same with, you know, resupplies with caddybacks, all the same. But for the younger guys out there listening, like, that's not just, you know, fodder, and obviously you better have a caddyback plan. And it better be a good one.
Better be a good one. All right, final question. How did this change you? How did this make you a better leader, Joe?
I'm more sensitive now. It changed me in a major way, like emotionally. Like I think about, you know, life and death things a lot more. It made me not afraid to tell another dude that I love him. You know, and that's not a big deal to me at all. Whereas probably before that, you know, all macho and whatever. I feel more human. As far as, I don't know if it made me a better leader or not, I think I just have experiences that, you know, other people may or may not have. My experiences are mine. I value certain things. I learned, like, so discipline, for example. I know we keep harping on that. The funny thing is, like, training guys for war during peacetime, if you don't go to war while you're training, I mean, they're going to, you know, like you were talking about, like, oh, that's why that sandbag's there. You know, like, they may not understand that ever. So you got to do the unpopular things. And it's just like what you were saying, the general said, you know, like, I'm going to give them what they need, not what they want. And that's when you do that in garrison and you're training, you know, during peacetime for war behaviors, it's almost never the popular thing. These guys, they got to be trained hard, they got to be trained fair, and they got to be trained professionally. That usually requires a lot of misery in training. And you have to be miserable in training, or you're not going to succeed when you're miserable in combat. That's just, I guess, my view. I don't know if that's changed any much. I have a bigger family now. You know, like I said, I still keep in touch with a lot of these, a lot of the Marines. I check up on them. So, like, because I love them, you know, like, I want to make sure they're still doing okay, and they check up on me too. They want to, like, holidays usually, Super Bowl, stuff like that, we'll get random, you know, texts going back and forth and making sure everybody's good. If someone was going through some pain, we'll all hear about it. We'll kind of surround them with, you know, love. So it leads, you know, coming back from this point, you know, like, it's not over. I still have an obligation to be there for these the Marines that were there with me, and they have an obligation to be there for me if I need them to. And that's emotional, physical, whatever the case is. We're bonded for life, and I know that sounds cliche, but the fact is, you know, we're all experiencing things on different timelines, and good things. I'm not just talking like mental health. I'm talking like kids, children, you know, marriage, and then of course, you know, mental health things. It's been 7 years, I think, 8 years, 7 or 8 years. And I can recall this like it was yesterday. And so I know, there's a lot of other, the guys that I was with then are in the same boat. And they know that they can pick up the phone and call at any time, and I'll come. So.
Hard to believe it's been 7 going on 8. I mean, when you said that, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. That's hard to believe. Joe, first of all, I want to thank you, for doing this. This is the second time you've been on, here in a week. And, if you don't mind, I want to ask you to come back one more time for about 30 minutes. And so,
no problem.
It's the follow-up, and that is that I'm doing with everybody, and I'll start it with Chris Bronzy, but it's the mental health part of this, coming back, and I can recall, I mean, for anybody who hasn't been there, there are certain sacred monuments that we have in the Marine Corps that are tributes to, that are our own tributes to our comrades. And they're very private places. They're sacred places. And if you've ever been to them, you know, you'll never forget what they look like. You'll never forget the heartfelt things that you see written, the combat decorations that are left there, the bottles of Jack Daniels, the 12 packs of beer, all the different things that the crazy things that get left up there as friends go to visit each other. And so I would be curious and would want to have you on one more time in this sequence of interviews that deal with the aftermath and the mental health piece, because I think we all go down that road once in our lives, and what have you learned and what advice would you offer to people? So if you don't mind doing one more of these, I would appreciate it.
No, I'd love to do that. That'd be really good.
Okay. My guest today has been the former company commander of Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, until about a month ago. He was the 3rd Platoon commander in India Company 3-5 during the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines deployment to Sangin in 2010, 2011. And so he's very graciously given up a few hours of his day today to join us. So, Joe, again, thank you very much for doing this. Thank you for making us smart about your platoon's fight in Sangin. And have a great day.
Well, thank you.
More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
That'll do it. A little walk with 3rd Platoon India Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines here. Pretty interesting. And that's what I love about these things, walking through in high definition what the job entails and the intensity that goes into everything you do, because you will truly bet your life on what you do. So my thanks to again to Joe Patterson, Captain Type, for coming on and sharing with us what they dealt with in Sangin in the fall of 2010 and the spring of 2011 during their deployment to the Helmand Valley of Afghanistan. So don't touch that dial. You're going to hear if you joined us late, you're going to hear news headlines, and there's a bunch of good ones, believe it or not. Yeah, good things happening. And there's still bad things going on, but some good things happen, so we're happy about it. Anyway, have a great Wednesday. We'll see you tomorrow. All Marine Radio, out.